aren't you knocking at my cellar door? I love you, baby, can I have some more? I hit the city and I lost my band. I watched the needle take another man. Gone, gone, the damage done. I sing the song because I love the man. I know that some of you won't understand. Milk blood to keep from running out. I've seen the needle and the damage done. A little part of it in everyone. And every junkie's like a setting sun.
We are live.
You know, we can pull from other recordings or other shows that the three of us do, right? And just straight up steal their segments. Because I feel like you in particular have some vacation results for a loose definition of vacation to share.
Yes. So I took a vacation to visit Casey. Now, ideally, I mean, if I'm honest, it was not entirely to visit Casey.
no, that was a happy coincidence, if we're honest with each other. But it worked out well.
Casey's there all the time, but there was something else that was there that made you go now.
Yes. One of my new favorite bands, Goose, was there playing a couple of shows in Richmond. And I decided, like, it's one of those things where, like, I looked, I'm like, I kind of want to see Goose's Fall. I was looking at, like, where they're playing. And, you know, I like a good venue. I also like good seats. And I looked, I'm like, oh, they're playing in Richmond. That's interesting. Maybe I could fly down there and see Casey and see Goose. And maybe I could even bring Casey to Goose. And then I looked, I'm like, I went on one of the ticket resale sites. And I'm like, let me see if I can get tickets. And there were three tickets in, like, basically, like, the best seats you could possibly have in this venue. It was like the first row of seats behind the general admission pit, but it's also like elevated 3 feet above the pit. So you're just looking across the top of everybody. You can be seated in a seat and be looking above the entire pit, and you're perfectly centered, it like the perfect distance from the stage to get all the light effects and everything. And I was like, oh, I can't let these go. And like, and you know, they were like, maybe they were pricey for Richmond, but they were not pricey for New York, if you know what I mean. So I was like, oh, yeah, this is a no-brainer. I'm getting these tickets. So I asked Casey real quick. I'm like, hey, by the way, are you free this night by any chance? Like, yeah, okay. So we booked everything, and Casey was, first of all, an amazing host. Like, so I flew in the day of the concert, like that morning, flew out the next day. Casey was basically like my private driver. Like, he drove me, he picked me up at the airport, dropped me off the next day at the airport, drove everywhere. And he even brought me to get this is how good of a friend Casey is. He brought me to a chicken salad place for lunch. Now, let me be clear. This is not a place that serves chicken salad. This is a place that serves only chicken salad. And this is a place that serves like 12 different flavors of chicken salad, and you can pick and you can get like one scoop of each one. And so that's what, like, what a good friend Casey is. Like, that's amazing.
Next day we had, what kind of chicken salad did you get? I'm dying to know now.
So they had a bunch of different options. Casey got like a barbecue one that I sampled, and then I got like their classic. I wanted to know, like, you know, what's their regular yeah. one. And I also got one that had like pineapple and stuff in it. It was fun.
You know, it's funny you say about the barbecue, because I understand where you're coming from.
It was
for the
good.
Record, this is a chain called Chicken Salad Chick. I think it's only in the Southeast U.S. And they do a couple of other things besides chicken salad. But for all intents and purposes, it's all chicken salad. And they have something like 12 of them. I forget exactly how many. We'll put a link in the show notes. But it's Chicken Salad Chick, right? So all of the names are silly, like takes on girls' names. The Barbie, think the doll with the letter Q, barbecue, get it? Barbie, Q, barbecue. I love that one. It is a very subtle barbecue flavor, but anyone I know that has tried it has at the very least said, oh, that's pretty good. I get why you would go, ugh, John, but truly, it's quite tasty.
It doesn't look as barbecue-y as I thought. It's just like barely pink.
Yeah, exactly.
You get like a hint of the barbecue flavor, but it's not like overwhelming. Right.
It's not like a chicken salad doused in barbecue sauce.
No. Then Marco got the classic Carol, and I forget what the other one was. Fruity Fran? No, you didn't have apple.
The only one that has pineapple.
Yeah, right. It doesn't matter. But suffice to say, there are all these little silly names. Well, and so the funny thing is, my perception of Marco is that, generally speaking, Marco would like something a little fancier than an equivalent to like a Panera Bread. But I was casting about thinking, where could I take Marco Arment for a meal that would be quick and easy after he's traveled? And even though the travel, I believe, was relatively easy, it's still travel. It's still tiring and whatnot. And I thought, oh, this is a man who used to go for chicken salad, what, every other day, every day for lunch?
Why are you avoiding saying that you're trying to take him to a place that is uniquely Southern? Because that seems like what you did.
That wasn't the impetus for it. The impetus was, this is a man who appreciates a chicken salad. Mm-hmm. Let's get some chicken salad.
Your other choice, I guess, would have been barbecue. Like, you want to take him
Well, hold on. Just you wait.
Funny you mentioned, we did barbecue the next day for lunch.
Exactly.
Sounds like a very healthy trip.
It was amazing.
The chicken salad wasn't terrible. I'm sure it wasn't great, but it wasn't terrible.
And that
the barbecue
even
was mostly protein.
They have red velvet cake, too.
We didn't have red velvet cake, though.
No, I wanted to fill up entirely on chicken salad. I'm like, I'm not going to have anything else here. I'm not going to, like, you know, I'm not going to waste stomach space on, like, potato salad or whatever. No, I'm going to have more chicken salad.
Oh, they have egg salad, too. Very nice.
Yeah, but that's like going to a steakhouse and ordering the fish. It's like you can do it, but like that's not really what
it's
for.
I mean, the distance between egg salad and chicken salad is not as far as the distance between fish and steak, I think.
Maybe.
But you're mostly eating mayonnaise in both cases.
True. Anyway, but regardless, even though we had this amazing chicken salad place and the following day, amazing barbecue, that was actually not the highlight of this trip. The highlight of this trip was the Goose Show. It was incredible.
It was so good. It was so good.
On multiple levels. Like, number one, to see this band that I now like a lot, you know, the second time I've seen them. It was, I would say, the second best concert I have ever seen. Like, the number one best was Fish at the Sphere night three that I went to. That was number one for me. This is number two. It was that good of a show. Like, Goose puts on, and this, again, I saw them a year ago, and that was also a great show. But they're even better now. Like they're getting refined, and they're getting, you know, more time together and more, you know, a bigger catalog. It was an amazing performance. It was an amazing show. They played so many of my favorite songs, including some that they hardly ever play. So that was very, very rewarding. And all of that was topped off by the topper that Casey seemed to really enjoy it. Now, some backstory here. You know, the listeners might recall, Casey and I often have some debates about whether his band, Mr. Dave Matthews, is considered a jam band or not. And so I thought, well, Goose is unquestionably a jam band. So I knew Casey probably couldn't handle Fish on his first try. Unless maybe I slipped him some gummies, then, you know, then anybody could enjoy it. But like,
all bets are off.
Right. But I figured, like, you know, an unadorned Casey probably would not go right from Dave to Fish. Like, that's a big jump. Goose has a lot closer to mainstream appeal compared to Fish. And so I thought, this is a good, like, step into my musical world. I thought maybe Casey would enjoy it. And it would at least show him, like, when I say that Dave Matthews is kind of a jam band, but not really, like, this is kind of what I'm comparing to. It's like, this is definitely a jam band. And maybe this would allow him to just, like, mildly appreciate the difference. But instead, like, days before the trip, Casey was, like, listening to a bunch of Goose, like, in preparation for the show, mm-hmm, and getting mm-hmm. really into it. And I'm like, oh, boy,
mm-hmm.
like, this could really become, like, an actual fan here. And not only was Casey visibly happy during the show, he was moving more than I was. Now, granted, you know, this is still like me doing my, like, you know, white guy at a jam band dancing.
Oh, same.
You know,
same,
it's
same,
like,
same.
This is a, let's not get carried away with what I mean by moving here. It's pretty limited.
No, hard same on that. But yes, I'm with you. I'm with you.
To have brought you to this, to have forced you to go listen to this band that you probably didn't think you would enjoy.
That's not entirely true, but finish your thought.
and then to see you get super into it and seem to really enjoy it was incredibly heartening. And it was a wonderful trip for lots of reasons. You know, Casey was amazing as a friend and as a chauffeur, and I got to spend a lot of time with his family, and that was really nice. And of course, the music was really nice, but to also, you know, expand the fandom of one of my favorite bands into somebody who I would describe as maybe a light skeptic of the genre was really quite special.
No, I appreciate it. I was very glad you came down. It was a semi last second thing. And the funny thing about it is it was whatever the recording we did right before I left for Memphis, you had kind of, what is the term or phrase, like floated the trial balloon or whatever, and said, hey, you know, Goose is a thing. It's coming to Richmond. Maybe we should do it. And I was like, yeah, okay, yeah, sure. Well, I'm sure it would be fine. And then as I'm trying to get to the airport, you're like, hey, let's do it. Let's buy tickets. Let's go. And you weren't doing anything wrong, but I'm trying to get to the airport. And I'm like, okay, fine, sure, great, whatever. Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm sure it was, I, at the time, I'm like, I'm sure it'll all work out. It'll be great. And so I go to Memphis, I do my thing. I come back from Memphis. I'm like, all right, now I got to do my deep dive on Goose. And I had heard a little bit of their stuff in the past. Like, you know, the algorithm had pushed a song or two here and there, and I liked it. It was fine. It was good. I liked it. And I generally just really love live music. I don't have the occasion to go see live music very often, but it, as I said to you probably 15 times over the couple of, or the really 24 hours you were here, you know, if you put me at a Phish show, as much as I joke and as much as I give you a hard time about it, I bet you I would enjoy it. I might leave it and say, that was fun. I don't need to do it again. But at the time, I think I would enjoy a Phish concert. And I figured it would be like that with Goose, maybe a little bit better. But as it turns out, these four dudes are unbelievably freaking good. And now I've basically listened to nothing but Goose ever since. I'm ruined. I'm ruined forever. It is really quite incredible. And the show was phenomenal. And we went with a friend of mine who had just recently moved to the area and I knew was also a Goose fan. And my friend Tyler was, I told him, hey, you know, I think Marco and I are going to go on Friday. And he was already slated to go on Thursday. And he said to me, well, I have a high school reunion I'm leaving for on Friday. You know what? Let me see if I can move my flight because it's not until Saturday. And I was like, all right. And so sure enough, Tyler went with us. And it was great to have two fans literally on either side of me. And I cannot thank Marco enough, not only for buying these tickets in annoyingly, but also courteously refusing payment for them. But truly, granted, this is a very small amphitheater in Richmond, Virginia. This may not be helpful to anyone else. But I tell you what, the seats Marco chose, as they were perfect. They were absolutely perfect. And it was such an unbelievable privilege and treat, not only to be there with Marco and my new friend Tyler, but also these seats were just incredible. And the concert was incredible. And what's great about these kinds of bands, jam bands or what have you, is that the next day, their entire concert from the soundboard was available on Bandcamp. We'll link the show. You can download it for, you know, $10+ if you want, which is what we did. And it's incredible. And then they also simulcast video. So if you happen to know a guy who's good with command line tools, as maybe Marco does, you can get a 1-month subscription to nugs.net, N-U-G-S, I think it is, .net. And you might be able to, I don't know, archive something on nugs.net if you try hard enough. So that means hypothetically one could have an entire video recording of this incredible concert. So it was a really great 24 hours. It was too quick. Like I don't fault you for the time you spent here. I don't fault you for not making like a week-long trip out of it, but it was great because at the end of the trip I thought, damn, that was great. I hope we get to do that again soon. And that's the right way to leave a vacation or trip or whatever you want to call it. But thank you again, Marco, for being such a wonderful person to hang out with for 24 straight hours. It was really great.
And you had
my favorite barbecue joint in town, ZZQ, and I like to think that went pretty well.
Oh, it was amazing. And I think the best part of it all is that because I know Minecraft, I was able to talk Minecraft to Casey's son. And because Casey does not play Minecraft, that made me the coolest person in the world in that moment.
I know enough Minecraft to have a conversation with him, and I understand the general gist of it, but I certainly do not have anywhere near the experience that Marco does. And so, again, speaking of trial balloons, I think Declan kind of threw up a trial balloon to see kind of whether or not Marco would bite, and because Marco's a good person, he did the kindness of biting, and then it was basically like, okay, let's talk Minecraft. So it was one of those situations where like, Declan, come on, I need you to go do this, or we need to go do that. I forget exactly what the situation was, but yeah, we got to go to the concert. I need you to wrap it up, big guy. Because he was overjoyed to talk your ear off, which was both adorable and also kind of funny.
At least he didn't ask you to install any mods.
That's true. That's true. I don't know really
how you two have managed to avoid that.
I'm sure, just give us time. It'll happen.
It's too late for Marco, probably.
Very true. But no, it was really great. And you know what? I was starting to go down this path. I got myself sidetracked. But again, I love live music. Even shows that I don't think I would enjoy, I end up typically enjoying because I just love watching live music. And I don't believe in reincarnation, but if reincarnation were a thing, I want to come back as a musician. Not even a good one, not even a popular one, just someone that could actually play music. And I am in awe at the amount of sound. I said noise, I think, on Friday night because I couldn't find a better word for it. And I didn't mean it in a pejorative way, but the amount of sound that came from four guys, it was just unreal. And I don't know if Goose is, and you know, anyone's particular cup of tea if you're listening to this, but if you are willing to just let a song really and truly air out in a way that even a Dave Matthews fan would be like, oh, they really aired that one out. It really is incredible. And I really do recommend their stuff. They have plenty of stuff on Apple Music and I presume on Spotify as well. But I ended up leaving that show very, very much a fan. And I was getting to the point that I was a fan by the time I walked in, but I was very much a fan leaving that show. And they really are incredible. And I think Marco had said to me during the show, which was to, I know we're going on long, I apologize, but I can't help myself. There was a set break in the middle of the show. So they played like hour and a half, and then they had a set break for all the old dudes to go pee, which the three old dudes went and did, and it was incredible. Mm-hmm. But we're talking during
along
the set
with 6,000 other old dudes.
Right, exactly. We're talking during the set break, and I think Marco had said to me, you know, what's incredible about Goose is it's clear that they are on the rise, and we are catching them on the early end of that. And I think from what I can tell, that's very much true. So if you want to get in on the ground floor or nearly the ground floor, now's the time.
Yeah, go see them while they're still playing medium-sized venues sometimes, because, like, you know, they've already sold out Madison Square Garden. Like, they're on their way up. It's going to become the venues are going to get larger over time, and the tickets will become more scarce and more expensive. And yeah, it's very special to be able to see them like in a small venue, small medium-sized venue like this, and and to be able to get those seats was incredible. And it's funny, like, and there was a point, like, in the second set, they went, I would say, in jam band terms, a little more atmospheric, maybe, is the term. Like, the second set was a little more exploratory, and there was some, like, you know, kind of, you know, discordant sections that they were playing around with, and I kind of look at Casey, I'm like, okay, this was a bit challenging for a non-jam band person. Like, I'm, like, kind of gauging, like, how is he taking this part? and he got through it, and I'm like, okay. I'm like, if he can get through that, I think he's ready for Fish next.
All right, pump the brakes there, Big Shoots. We'll see. I don't know. It's probably only a matter of time. But no, Goose, to my ears, Goose is, and you said this starting the segment, Goose is considerably more approachable and less esoteric. Now, maybe fast forward 2 years, maybe I'll have a totally different opinion. But sitting here now, that's how I would describe it. But again, thank you for facilitating, for making it happen, for dealing with me kind of like half paying attention to you as you're trying to book tickets as I'm on the way to the airport. And again, for purchasing the tickets, because they truly hand on heart, I cannot think of a better place to stand in that venue than where we were standing. We were incredibly lucky. So thank you much, Lee. Let's do it again.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's do some fun stories in Recognition Corner. Richard Ernie was recognized in an ATP Pixel shirt upon arriving in a place in Scotland. We'll get to that in a second. We talked about this last week. Matt Smith wrote in and said, I was that person that recognized the guy in Scotland. And apparently I just absolutely murdered the pronunciation of this city. I am happy to make an attempt, but John, would you like to instruct me on the correct pronunciation options, please?
This shades a little bit into, you did pronounce it weirdly, and this shades a little bit into the discussion I had in Rectifs about, like, do you pronounce the name of a place in the native language of the place? But here's the thing. The native language of Scotland is ostensibly English, or the most common language in Scotland is English, right?
For a loose definition, it's very much English different.
Right, okay. But so that's like, all right, so the example using Rectif was like Paris. We say Paris, but French people don't say Paris. They say Paris or whatever, right? And are we pronouncing it wrong when we say Paris? No, because that's how you say the capital city of France in English. So how do you say this city in Scotland? Should we say it in a Scottish accent or should we not? And what is the quote unquote like American English way to say this city? So you didn't say, you just pronounced it phonetically, right? What I've heard in the United States is one of the pronunciations that a Scottish person will tell you is just wrong. They'll say it's not Edinburgh, like a borough of New York City. There are five boroughs, right? Edinburgh. That's the Scottish person will say, nope, wrong. You don't have it. I'm like, well, that's not how you pronounce it, but I do hear that a lot in the U.S. But anyway, going by what Scottish people say, and I looked this up and tried to find some reasonable pronunciations, I found a funny one from someone saying, here's three valid pronunciations, which, like, based on how much of a hurry you're in, how much you just swallow up the word. So one is Edinburgh, where it's B-U-H-R-U-H, Burra, Edinburgh. If you're even more in more of a hurry, you can say Edinburgh. Now the Burra becomes Bruh, Edinburgh.
Bruh.
And if you're really in a hurry and you're native Scottish, you can say Embra. And now I'm not saying these with a Scottish accent, so maybe they sound weird. But anyway, Edinburgh.
They definitely sound weird.
And Burra sounds to me like a Scottish way of saying borough, but I guess not. We can't say Edinburgh, so we'll say Edinburgh. And there you have it. So we'll just got to make sure we say Melbourne and Edinburgh or Embra. Anyway, it's definitely not Edinburgh. And Casey, you said Edinburgh, which is definitely wrong.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from. I don't, that is lunacy. I will be the first to fall on my sword about that one. That was lunacy.
But you're just pronouncing it phonetically, which is fine. But that's, you know, it's not the
yeah. I after college, I moved to Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And then continuing in Recognition Corner, Santiago Hervella writes, longtime listener, first-time caller, and day one Overcast user, writing in.
Hey.
On episode 659, you told the story about how Mark Christian was wearing an ATP shirt in Manhattan when they were tapped by some nerd who showed them their Overcast app, currently listening to ATP. That was me. I'm that nerd. Mark was very gracious when he thought I was just grabbing his attention for something, and even more so when I showed him my phone screen. It was hilarious to hear you describe that interaction while I was walking to the office not two blocks from that same spot.
This ATP is becoming a misconnection for nerds.
Yeah.
I saw you on the subway and you were listening to a nerdy podcast and I said hi, but then I didn't get your number.
That's great.
Make some love connections here.
All right, let's talk AirPods 3 and particularly the ear lottery. Michael writes, I had the same AirPods Pro 3 experience as Marco, and I also ordered the AirPods Pro 2 again. I can keep them in my ear all day, forgetting they're there. I spent 2 weeks trying to get the AirPods Pro 3 working for me. It was okay initially, but it started to hurt quickly. Franklin Delano Stallone writes, I had the same issue as Marco with new AirPods, but it went away in just about over a week. So I've either stretched out my ears or a level of earwax on the AirPods has helped. AirPods would always be a bit of a pain for me when I clean them fully, so there's possibly something there. But while the noise canceling is better, I kind of wish they'd go back to the old style. Matthew Schaefer writes, my wife has had AirPod Pro 2 since around the time they were released. She said they don't cancel noise very well. This made my ears perk up because pretty much everyone agrees that the ANC is very good. So I had her stand next to a running fan and switch the ANC off and on, and she said there really wasn't much of a difference. She could hear the fan just fine. This was shocking to me. Apparently, she just thought her experience was normal this whole time. I had her put in my brand new AirPods Pro 3s, and her words exactly were, that's approximately 5,000 times better. AirPods Pro 2 didn't fit in her ears, regardless of which tips she used. I had no clue this whole time that they've been working about as good as cheap non-ANC earbuds. Obviously, I went out and bought her some AirPods Pro 3s right then and there. Finally, Michael Gock writes, for me, the AirPods Pro 3 were slightly uncomfortable. I ended up going up in tip size. They don't go in as far, and they're great now. You mentioned trying smaller sizes, but did you try the larger ones?
When Michael said this, it kind of stuck in my brain. I had literally shipped them off to be returned that morning.
You're so hasty to throw out your non-working keyboards and return your AirPods. You gotta chill a little. At least wait 1 week for follow-up.
Well, I didn't want to hit the 2 week deadline. So I'm like, that's annoying. And then there were these YouTubers who were like, well, if you angle them differently, because basically, the way most people wear AirPods, what direction are the stems pointing? And most people, it's somewhere between straight down and straight, 40 or 90 degrees forward. And it's it's either straight vertical or straight horizontal, anywhere in between there. And it turns out a lot of people are saying, if you angle them too far down, they fit wrong, basically, or they fit less comfortably for a lot of people. And what you're supposed to do, apparently, with the threes is angle them so the stems basically form a line towards your mouth.
So on that theory, we've all seen people with AirPods of many different generations with those stems pointing in every direction imaginable.
Yeah.
Sometimes in just ridiculous directions. You're like, there's no way those are in right. But hearing all the things about how, from the doctors, about how the inside of our ear canals go off in all sorts of weird directions, I do wonder if it's just the whole reason there's the ear lottery is everyone's ears are a little bit different. And so for some people, maybe when we see them with the stems pointing up at an angle and out away from their head, like antennas or something, maybe that's how their ear is shaped and that's the best position for them. Or maybe they just don't know how to use earpods. I don't know. But I do feel that there is a huge amount of variability in what the correct angle is for you. I know which video you're talking about. Point it towards your mouth. If that works for you, great. But I feel the lesson is, try that thing pointing in different directions, because who knows which direction will work for your weird ears.
Yeah. So between those videos and between Michael's post here, kind of infecting my brain, I tried the default medium and everything smaller. I didn't actually try the large tips. So I'm like, you know what? Fine. Amazon could deliver me a pair the next morning.
Oh, here we go.
Did you get some third-party tips for them too?
So I ordered the Amazon ones. They came the next morning. I've been testing them out with the large tips and with them pointing towards my mouth instead of a little bit further down. They are a lot more comfortable that way.
Oh, look at that. That's awesome.
So
comfortable enough for you to keep them, though?
I think so. In reality, they are better in a few ways I do care about. Like, they do sound better. They don't sound massively better, but they do sound better. You know, as mentioned, you know, in the past, like, you know, the bass is a little bit better. The treble is a decent amount better. The sound stage is a bit wider. Like, you know, they do sound better and they do isolate better during noise canceling mode. Almost too well for, like, walking around, actually. But, you know, there's lots of other times when you want to use them. So, like, I think overall they are better. The water resistance is better. You know, like, there's lots of things about them that are better. So I want them to work for me. Ultimately, with the largest ear tips and with them angled towards my mouth, they fit comfortably enough that so far I haven't tried them for more than, like, 2 hours straight. But for 2 hours straight, I was able to wear them and it was fine. And that was not the case with the smaller ear tips ever, at all. So I've now gotten to the point where they are fine. The twos are still more comfortable, but the threes are now good enough with these modifications. So I can keep them. I'm still not sure that I will keep them because the twos are easier and better for me. But I probably will keep them now. We'll see.
So wait till you build up some earwax.
Yeah.
Could be. All right. And then with regard, further regard to active noise cancellation, Tony Denke writes, I used the AirPods Pro 3 on a recent long-haul 787 flight and compared them to the Bose Quiet Comfort Ultra over-ear headphones. The AirPods Pro 3 were massively better than the Ultras. I was amazed. Combine that with the lighter, less vibration noise risk from contact with a hard surface in the seat, the AirPods Pro 3 won. Battery life was seriously impressive, too.
That is a very real thing if you've ever been on a plane, especially if you have the window seat like I always try to have. And if you're wearing over-ear headphones and you touch the outside of the case of those headphones to the wall of the plane.
Oh, yeah.
It's a bad news. And that's much less likely to happen when you've got a tiny earbud in.
Yeah, I mean, the noise cancellation is so much better on the threes. And it was all like the twos were already good enough that I would use them on planes because, again, like the bag space savings are just so big that it was always worth it to me. And then the threes take it even further. And so I think, like, as long as the threes can be comfortable for you, I don't see much reason for most people to get the giant headphones anymore. Like, if you are getting them for noise cancellation on planes or during work or during walking around or whatever, I think if the Pros threes are comfortable enough for you, I think they're better than the over-ear headphones for most people most of the time.
And then apparently, Marco, you've done a little bit of an experiment.
Yes.
I did too.
Oh, cool. Oh. I'd love to. So a bunch of people kept asking me, like, hey, have you done the live translation with the new AirPods? Like, regular people in my life, like people like in stores and stuff, friends, like people who don't follow the tech that closely, but they've heard about that.
They don't know they can probably do them with their own AirPods.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, number one thing to know, again, if people in your life are asking you about the live translation feature, keep in mind that it doesn't require the Pro 3s. It also works on the Pro 2s and the AirPods 4 with noise cancellation. So if you have either of those models, you already have access to live translation. And you just download Apple's translation app if you don't already have it, and there's a whole tab, you know, a live conversation tab. So I've actually tried this now. We had a staff party for the restaurant, and we had some chefs who speak Spanish. And so we tried it out, like Spanish to English. I downloaded the model, so it should be like maximum speed. We had our server speaking in English, and we had a chef speaking in Spanish, and we had them kind of gauge like, you know, how accurate it was. And it was okay. Like, so number one thing is, like, it is a little bit awkward when no one's done it before or seen it before. Like, you gotta be like, oh wait, who holds the phone? Where do I face it? Who's looking at
right,
what
right.
Do I speak? Does it speak to me? Like, so getting all that worked out is it takes some doing. And then the Spanish option, it's like, it's Spanish parentheses Spain. So this is like Spanish as spoken in Spain. It's varies a lot, you know, as from like Spanish in other regions and languages and cultures and everything like that. And so, and I didn't say anything about that, but like within the first two sentences, our chef who was looking at the translation, he's like, this is Spain Spanish. Like, he knew instantly. He was like, this is not what we speak in the kitchen. This is a Spain thing. This is very different. So he instantly called it out. But overall, like, it was good enough – to get the gist of what people are saying. It's not perfect by any means. It missed a lot of things. It missed a lot of, you know, nuance. It missed a lot of like references and, you know, stuff like that, like, you know, idioms, slang, like it missed a lot of that stuff. But it did communicate the gist of what was being said. It was not super reliable. It was not super graceful, and it was not super fast, but it did work. And so it, and I tested it a second time when I brought it earlier today. I brought it to another place where some friends work, and they tried it with one of their people who speaks Spanish and one of their people who speaks English, and did the same thing, and basically had exactly the same result. Like, it's a little awkward. No one knows what to do quite, you know, at first, but then you try it, and it's like, okay, that's kind of the gist of what I said, and, you know, and it's slow. So I think it is going to be the kind of thing that, like, it will be useful in a pinch, you know, certainly while traveling, if you got to work something out with somebody. It's not, like, very natural and conversational. Like, you have to speak pretty slowly. You have to speak pretty loudly for it to hear you or hear the other person correctly. Again, like, it is slow and awkward when people are not used to it. So it's the kind of thing that I can see being about as useful as, like, Google Translate has always been. And it's the kind of thing that I can definitely see Apple's version being fine, but Google and maybe OpenAI probably do a much better job of this. And certainly, as we go into the future, I can see Apple's version staying exactly the way it is now, and Google and OpenAI's versions being a lot better overall. So I'm glad this tech exists. It's very impressive, but it's not quite as natural as what everybody might assume or want it to be. And I don't expect Apple's going to be the best company to do this long term.
Now, very quick question. Were you basically a passive viewer, for lack or listener in this? Like, you weren't doing any of the talking?
Yes.
Oh, and that was still supported. It's just whatever it hears, it's bringing in and doing its thing.
Well, I was like, you know, the listener was wearing my AirPods and holding my phone.
Oh, okay. I got you.
I was watching and like and kind of telling people, because they would ask, wait, do I talk? I say, no, you talk. You listen. Like, I was kind of telling them what to do.
I see. Okay.
You know, because they didn't really know. But so it's a cool feature. It's not going to revolutionize communication any more than Google Translate does, but that's not nothing. Like, that's pretty useful in a lot of cases. So I think it'll be a great, like, casual travel aid. But, you know, it's not gonna be as seamless as it was in the commercial.
Gotcha. All right, John, you said you also tested it?
Yeah, I wish I had saved some of these things. So first of all, I don't even remember if this follow-up ever made it into one of the episodes, but someone had sent us a thing that, saying that Apple's live translation, despite the Translate app having like the option of like, oh, we'll go to the server for this, but we'll download these models, blah, blah, blah. Supposedly the AirPods live translation only ever uses local models for some privacy reason. That's, if true, and it seems like it was based on that link that I can no longer find that we may or may not have talked about in a past episode. That is going to hold Apple back, because obviously the models that run on the server can be way better than anything running locally. Now, obviously you have more latency when you go to the server, but if you have a really good network connection, that can be alleviated, especially since it seems like most of the time you're waiting for the model to compute the result, and maybe a server could actually even be faster there if you can get the audio up to it or the whatever text up to it as fast as possible, depending on what it's doing. Anyway, when this came out, like when it was first available, I tried it, but I didn't have anyone to speak another language with, so I tried to give it like what I felt like was a really challenging scenario where I'm going to sit in front of my computer screen and I'm going to pull up a Spanish-speaking YouTube channel. And that YouTube channel is not doing like what, you know, being coached by a Marco and trying to speak in non-idiomatic, very simple sentences
slowly
to get your point
clearly
across. Right. This was just, you know, rapid fire, real, you know, like a YouTuber, but in Spanish. And I was amazed that, as far as I could tell, it got the gist of it. I can't judge the translation because I don't speak Spanish, but looking at, because it shows you both of them, looking at like what it thinks the Spanish is and then what the English is, I can't tell you whether the English is a correct reflection of the Spanish, but I can tell you the Spanish was looking kind of like what they were saying. I was amazed that it worked at all, honestly, because this is not a real person. It's a computer screen playing out of the computer speakers. I'm wearing AirPods. And yeah, there is a delay, but I was impressed that it did anything. Now, I've heard people report, we had some feedback. Some people said, I tried it, had these two people try it, somebody spoke, and the thing just didn't do anything. Like, it didn't start translating at all. Like, as with any of the stuff in iOS 26 or any of this new stuff, there are definitely bugs. And I can imagine scenarios where it just falls on its face and doesn't think there's anything it's supposed to translate or can't understand it at all. Again, Marco mentioned the various different dialects of Spanish. There are enough of them and they're different enough from each other, including not just the pronunciation, but the actual words and everything about them can change in ways that can thwart the model. So Apple has added more languages and hopefully they'll add more like localizations of different kinds of Spanish. Even within Spain, there's plenty of different kinds of Spanish within the regions. But it is impressive that it works at all. It's again, it's not really an AirPods feature. It's really just a feature of your phone that is connecting to the AirPods, which is fine. But I was impressed that it was able to do a YouTube video. Like I could probably watch the YouTube video. Now, honestly, it would be better if I just turned on the auto-generated English subtitles for the YouTube video, because I can imagine Google doing it server-side is still better. But it was neat.
All right. With regard to last week's Ask ATP question about filling SSD and particularly iPhone storage, David Schaub writes, "My iPhone 8 got full once, resulting in a reboot loop whenever Springboard loaded." Yikes. The solution, accept a call from the lock screen, add a person, type in the passcode, go to control center, try and change the Wi-Fi, go into Wi-Fi settings, and then once you're in settings, delete all the things. David continues, never let an iPhone have less than about 5 gigs of free space. Why does iOS let you fly so close to the sun? Recovery should have a boot directly to settings option.
Don't make the phones angry. They don't like it.
Nope. Additionally, with regard to phones, Mike Taffet did some science, which was very kind of him. Mike writes, I just transferred from an iPhone 17 Pro Max to an iPhone 17 Pro, both wired via 2.5 gigabit Ethernet adapters that also take in power through a 10 gigabit Ubiquiti switch. Neither device ran out of power, but also the Unify interface allowed me to see the bandwidth being used by each port. It seems this transfer was running on average about 500 to 600 megabits per second. So for simplicity, I don't see any reason why Wi-Fi isn't the best option.
Again, the USB port is 10 gigabits. This was running at 500 to 600 megabits, probably because it was transferring lots of small files.
Yeah. Then we have some feedback with regard to Marco's USB Odyssey. This was Marco figuring out that, or discovering that you couldn't plug in a USB 2 device to your Thunderbolt hub, right? Is that a fair summary?
Yeah. If any USB 2 device that was plugged in through any Thunderbolt hub in any method, except through the ProDisplay XDR's back ports, would not work anymore. And I had traced the problem to a bad cable. That once I changed out the cable that ran from the Thunderbolt hub to the laptop, the problem was fixed.
Jack Wolborn writes, I had a Thunderbolt cable fail on me a little over a year ago, and while it wasn't the same symptoms that Marco had, it did involve only some devices working. In my case, it was the USB devices that worked and the Thunderbolt ones that didn't. Sid Polkst writes, I'm starting to think that Tahoe and the latest version of Sequoia made a change in the Thunderbolt or USB that breaks older USB or Thunderbolt hubs. My OWC Thunderbolt 4 hub stopped serving USB. My CalDigit 3 at work. Now kernel panics my Mac unless I unplug all of my USB devices. I bought a CalDigit TS5 for my M1 Max MacBook Pro, and it works flawlessly. Fabian writes, Fabian was arguably the best person to describe what they were talking about, but we heard this from a lot of people, and I should have thought of this as well. But anyway, Fabian writes, my USB extension cable came with a sticker that reads, quote, USB 2.0 low speed devices, such as a mouse, keyboard, USB 2.0 flash drive, USB 2.0 of hub, etc. This is not Fabian's fault. This is the sticker. Can only work with one side of the ultra high rate extension cable's interface. If USB 2.0 devices do not work as you expected, please flip the Type-C connector over and connect again. So Fabian writes, maybe that's why you had inconsistent results with the same hardware, an inadvertently flipped connector. Additionally, Keith Heaton provided a pinout, or whatever you would like to call it, a pin diagram of the USB-C connector, and we will put a link to that in the show notes. And it says, Keith writes, USB 2 data runs on the A6 and A7 or B6 and B7 pins of a Type-C connector. If only the A bank or B bank has an issue, you might be able to keep using that expensive cable by rotating the connector 180 degrees so that the hub and the computer are both using the functional bank. Even without a cable tester, there are only 4 possible combinations. This is worth noting as well. So in my tailgate tub that we've talked about in the past, I have a GLINET router that that can take in tethering, including via phone, via a USB-A connector. But on the front of the tailgate tub, I put in USB-C connectors. And so internal to the tailgate tub, I have a C to A line, cable, whatever. And I've noticed that I need to make sure that I connect it the exact same way. So I drew on the connector, you know, with like a silvery Sharpie that shows up in the black connector, which side needs to be on which side of the input on the tailgate tub. So basically I'm connecting the two sides correctly. Because I found, wait, why is this not working? Why is this not working? Why is this? Oh, flip. There it goes. Works perfectly now. And I didn't think of this when we were recording, but I should have. So my apologies to you, Marco.
Well, I mean, if it makes you feel any better, I would not accept that solution. what it basically says is like, if one side's pins go bad or whatever part of that controller, like if one side of pins goes bad, the other side might still work. So flip it over and try it. That to me is not a solution. The solution is fair. Replace the thing that is bad. Because
but in this case,
I'm
like,
not
going to
like it because it'd be one thing like if this is the kind of thing like if it's part of my setup that I just plug it in once and it stays there for years, maybe I'd tolerate that. But this is like when I take my laptop to go somewhere, I unplug this cable and bring it somewhere. And then when I get back, I plug this cable back into the laptop and I would not tolerate it working half the time and having to flip it over for that situation.
But to be clear, that's not really the cable's fault, as far as I understand. It's just circumstantially, there's USB 2 pins on both sides, and perhaps somewhere...
No, but they're duplicated. So theoretically, it should be able to... like, you should be able to plug in a USB-C or Thunderbolt cable in either direction on either end of the cable, and everything should work. If everything is working properly, it does not matter which direction you plug it in. What they're saying basically is like sometimes things don't work properly, and it can start to matter. But in that case, like something is broken, and so you know, consider replacing it.
Or the thing with the sticker that Fabian sent is probably they left out two conductors to save money.
Right, exactly.
Right.
They're trying to
which
say,
to me is
that.
Broken.
Yeah. There was someone else wrote in, I don't have the details of it, it was just like wrote in just a couple of hours ago about the idea of a dedicated, like the USB 2 alternate mode where you have dedicated pins on the Thunderbolt cable just for USB. But the other version is where you don't use that alternate mode and you tunnel everything through Thunderbolt. And the theory is that the XDR is tunneling everything through PCIe and Thunderbolt, whereas the cheaper hubs and other things are using the USB alternate mode and having the dedicated wires, which is why if one set of those four wires, one pair of those four wires went bad on your cable, yeah, maybe it would work flipped, but I would definitely get a new cable.
Then with regard to active versus passive Thunderbolt cables.
This was such a nightmare. There's like three things in here, but it's because I thought, oh, we'll get one thing in here. Someone said a thing. I'm like, let me try to get an authoritative source, and then you'll see. It just goes down this terrible rabbit hole where there's no straightforward answer. But we'll try to give you three buckets of information. See if you can reconcile them without reading the freaking Thunderbolt spec.
So on OWC's website, they write that Thunderbolt 3 cables longer than 7/10 of a meter are active cables, which do not support DisplayPort. Thunderbolt 3 cables that are 1 meter or longer, there are passive cables, which are 20 gigabit Thunderbolt 3. They support 10 gigabit USB DisplayPort and works with a USB-C display directly. Active cables are up to 40 gigabit Thunderbolt 3, up to 480 megabit USB. It does support DisplayPort, but it does not work with the USB-C display directly.
So even that, this is OWC. Like, they're a big hardware manufacturer for Mac stuff. You figure their web, they know what they're talking about. They're a pretty authoritative source, right? Already, from these two bullet points, they're contradictory. Thunderbolt cables longer than 0.7 meters are active, but then it tells me about a passive cable that's 1 meter or longer, but it's 20 gigabits. Like, their two bullet points contradict each other. If I have a 1 meter cable, well, I'm sure that it has to be active because it says that if they're longer than 0.7 meters, they're active, except when they're passive. But then they're 20 gigabits, but then they have 10 gigabit USB. But if you have a 40 gigabit one that's active, then you only have 480 megabits USB. Sure, that's just OWC. Then I'm like, originally I came up with a Reddit result, but I'm like, no, let me find something more authoritative. Let me go to OWC. But nope, now I'm going back to Reddit.
All right, so there's a Reddit, there's a Reddit comment from LaughingMan11 on active versus passive Thunderbolt cables, which reads, cables rated at 40 gigabits per second with a length of 0.8 meters of all kinds, Thunderbolt 3, Thunderbolt 4, USB 4, are 100% guaranteed to be passive. If you see 40 gigabits certified cable at 0.8 meters or shorter, it is a passive cable. For distances between 0.8 and 2 meters, some cables are actually certified passive cables. I've seen cable manufacturers stretch and make 1 meter 40 gigabit per second passive cables with no problems. They manage to squeeze the extra 0.2 of a meter and keep up the signal integrity just fine.
So, again, there's more info in that post. I just pulled this out, but at least it sounds very authoritative. And, you know, Laughing Man is a reference from an anime series that I like, so I'm on board with Laughing Man 11 from Reddit versus OWC, the company. But at least it's not self-contradictory, these 2 points, you know, and it does really outline that it is possible to have passive cables. In fact, passive cables that are longer than you would expect.
Then, as with all things, we turn to Wikipedia, and Wikipedia writes, copper Thunderbolt 4 cables of up to 1 meter are passive cables, while longer cables must integrate active signal conditioning circuitry. 2 meters maximum is the length of active cables available for most brands, including CalDigit, Cable Matters, etc., while Apple is currently the only company that offers a 3 meter active copper cable.
It's madness. It's mad. Like, just, I dare you to Google this. Notice how all the numbers change? 1 meter, 0.8, 0.7. Some companies have been extended to this thing. Active, passive, how fast things go. The only thing I took from this stupid adventure that I spent so long wandering through, and I found way more than just OWC, Reddit, and Wikipedia, but this is a sampling, is that passive Thunderbolt cables exist. That's it. That's all I can come away with. And they're probably short.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair. Oh, gracious. All right. We spoke about some alternatives to Synology, I don't know, a week or two ago. I forget exactly when it was. It doesn't matter. But Colin McKellar writes, have you ever considered QNAP NASs, QNAP? They're fairly equivalent to Synology in terms of hardware and capabilities, but they have not followed Synology in limiting the drives that can be used.
So I looked at QNAP back in the day, and I looked again when Colin mentioned it, and they've come pretty far since I last checked them out. Their software stack looks very Synology-ish, sometimes down to the exact same like name brand apps or similar-looking apps. And the other thing QNAP has going for them is that they support ZFS, which I like. It is the thing about ZFS, and I looked at this when I was looking at the QNAP stuff, is like it's got way more features than... it's got lots of cool features. It's got like the automatic self-healing replication. It's got tons and tons of options. But it is very enterprise-y in that it is farther from the Drobo Dream than the Synology setup. The Drobo Dream, for people don't remember Drobo, was you buy this big box full of drives, and whenever you need more storage, you add another drive of any size you feel like, and it just adds to the space, and it maintains whatever level of data protection that you had. It's like
it
very, very flexible.
Very disastrously.
Right. Well, that was the pitch, right? Because that appeals to consumers. Consumers aren't going to buy fleets of things with giant hard drives that are like, I'm just going to buy as many drives as I can afford, and later when I want more space, I'll buy another drive or whatever I can afford and stick it in. And I don't have to have all the drives be the same size or make subgroups or make separate VDEVs and add them to the ZFS RAID Z pool and all that. Like, I don't want to think about that. I just want to buy a drive for whatever amount of money I have and stick it in. 3 years later, do the same thing and stick it in. And I want data protection, whatever data protection I picked when I set up this array, I want that data protection to be maintained as I add drives, and I don't care what size they are. And that is not what ZFS delivers. ZFS wants you to add things in a more regimented manner. It's not as flexible. When you add things, you can't always add any drive of any size. Sometimes it does want you. You can add like drives in pairs and add new things to your pool. Like there are ways to get some more flexibility than just like you have to replace every drive like in traditional RAID, but it's more fidgety. But anyway, I do like ZFS. But then I looked at the prices, and QNAP stuff is just as expensive as Synology. So it's like, I mean, maybe not as expensive. I think they have like better CPUs and more RAM for the same as Synology's prices. But anyway, QNAP, if you're looking for an alternative to Synology, just looking at their product offerings, they seem to be the closest thing to Synology that I've seen. Their software stack really does look like they're copying everything that Synology has in a good way. And they have the option of using ZFS. You don't have to use ZFS. You can use plain old RAID. You can use ZFS. Anyway, I was impressed with how far QNAP has come. Also, some other recommendations people had for us were Ugreen, which is the company that I just think of as making like USB hubs and Ethernet hubs and stuff like that. But apparently they make NAS hardware now too. Unraid is a software solution. Then there's FreeNAS, TrueNAS. There's tons of options for you out there, depending on how much stuff you want to do. But QNAP look like the same type of solution as Synology, in that like you give us money, we take care of everything. Like it's not DIY. It's not like you can get down nitty gritty and do like fancy stuff with ZFS. But if you just want to buy like an appliance and use an interface to set it up, QNAP will do that for you, and it does have features that Synology doesn't because it has ZFS.
Cool. That's all very useful, and I appreciate all the feedback from everyone, but I have news. As of about 24 hours from now or thereabouts, Synology has mostly backtracked on their complete refusal to work with third-party drives. So
that Synology Europe thing we had last episode was right. The
it
YouTube
turns out.
That stray YouTube comment from the official Synology at Europe account.
Who'd thunk it? So Synology released Disk Station Manager 7.3. DSM is their, you know, like operating system, if you will. And their press release reads, Synology is currently collaborating closely with third-party drive manufacturers to accelerate the testing and verification of additional storage drives, and will announce more updates as soon as possible. In the meantime, 25 model year Disk Station Plus, Value, and J series running DSM 7.3 will support the installation and storage pool creation of non-validated third-party drives. This provides greater flexibility while Synology continues to expand the lineup of officially verified drives that meet long-term reliability standards. However, the creation of M.2 based storage pool and cache still requires drives from the HCL. I have no idea what that means, but
from the hardware compatibility list. So, but
no,
basically the asterisk, it was like a footnote one saying, we'll support the creation of non-validated third-party drives. Footnote, and the footnote was, yeah, except for M.2 ones. There's more detail from this SpaceRex YouTube channel here.
All right, so from SpaceRex YouTube, the M2 NVMe restrictions are still in place due to the highly diverse M2 NVMe market and wide variation. We've seen many instances where consumer-grade M2 SSDs with low endurance performance and quality combined with poor firmware implementations have directly contributed to system instability and data loss.
And that's directly from Synology. This was the SpaceRex YouTuber asking Synology, hey, what's the deal? Why can't we do NVMe? Why can't we use arbitrary third-party NVMe flash drives? And that's Synology's explanation. Still only the approved list for those.
And then Lee Hutchinson at Ars Technica writes, we asked Synology whether the requirements will also be lifted from previous generation Synology products, and the answer to that question appears to be a no. Quote, this change only affects the 25 series models, blah, 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 blah. Models in the XS Plus line are considered a business or enterprise model and will remain under the current HCL policy for our business lines. Synology
explained. HCL is not hydrochloric acid, but hardware compatibility list. So this is why I say they mostly backtracked. They're trying to have their cake and eat it too. Like their enterprise product lines, this XS Plus line, still only Synology validated drives. Old pre-2025 products, and that is Synology products that don't end in 25, because all their products like DS725, DS225, those are all 2025 products. If you have a product that's not a 2025 product, you're not included in this either. It's only exactly what the press release says, which is the only running DSM 7.3, and it's the Plus, Value, in J series, which I imagine are what consumers buy, right? So they're trying to say, enterprises with lots of money, we still want to sell you overpriced storage, because that's what every storage company in the enterprise does. Like, it's how, you know, these big companies make a lot of their money. But for consumers, because you all got mad at us, we will let you do this, but only if you buy a new 2025 thing or you have one of the really older ones. If you got caught in that middle thing, too bad for you, which is still kind of crappy. Like, so I'm saying, like, if you're gonna walk this back, walk it back all the way. They're walking it back halfway, which is better than nothing, but still not great.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to make of this. That is probably enough to make me consider going, well, I'm saying going back as though I've left, but, you know, whenever the time comes that I replace my like 2-year-old model, if this continues for the home market, I'd probably stick with Synology, but it's certainly kind of put a gross taste in my mouth, and we'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah, a lot of the YouTubers, a lot of the various people reporting on this news were like, in typical YouTube fashion, would come right out and say, this is because their sales got destroyed when they did this. And it's like, well, do you have their sales numbers, like citation needed, as they say in Wikipedia? Like, probably their sales went down. We know that there was lots of people complaining about it, but like they just definitively say it's because their sales were, you know, in the toilet. It's like, well, you know, like I would like to see some. Anyway, the bottom line is they want to sell to enterprises. Everyone who sells to enterprises makes you buy their storage. Like if you buy like EMC or I think Dell owns them now, or all the other big, like I had to deal with all these vendors and doing like a, vendor evaluation for lots of big storage vendors for a big storage project back when I had a jobby job. So I got to hear all their sales pitches, and they all want to sell you just the most expensive hard drives you've ever seen in your entire life. Like, mm-hmm. that, it's like Apple with RAM and storage. Like, storage. That's where all their margins come from. And you can see why Synology wants to do that, too. Their mistake was thinking they could also apply to that to people who want to have, like, a two-drive NAS in their basement or something. And that has not worked out. So I think QNAP is probably reaping the benefits. I would definitely consider trying them, but now that Synology is backtracking mostly on this, and if I ever buy a new one, it'll be a 2025 model or later, I'm like, I'll probably just stick with Synology.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, let's do some more first impressions, but I actually have a very quick bit of, I guess it's sort of kind of follow-up, sorry, John, about the AirPods Pro 3. After hearing the discussion about, oh, you should try the bigger tips, I thought to myself, you know what, I should try the bigger tips. What's it going to hurt? And even though I didn't feel like the tips were not snug in my ears, I thought, let me give it a whirl. And I've tried the bigger tips, which I think there's only one step larger, if I'm not mistaken, in the box from what they have mounted on the device. And you can option into one size larger, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And I tried that. And I got to tell you, they fit just fine. And who'd have thunk it? The ANC got just a touch better. I wouldn't say it was bad before. I wouldn't say it's night and day better than the AirPods Pro 2, but it's definitely a touch better. So even if you don't think you need the bigger tips, give it a shot. Can't hurt, just like Marco was saying earlier. Marco, you have some case updates for us.
I do, yeah. So in the intervening time, last episode of this one, I have tried three new iPhone 17 Pro cases. As I wait for my Suti leather back to be delivered ever. I don't even think it has shipped yet. I think I need to email
Speaking of your leather back, by the way, did you see that person who had your leather back and just cut the top off of it? I meant to say that when you were talking about cutting the top off of one of your older cases. But did
yeah,
you see
I mean,
that person's post?
Certainly that person did a much better job than I did. but
you were using a leather back for an earlier phone.
Oh, right.
Sticking it on your 17. This person took the leather back for the 17 Pro that you returned and just cut the top off of that one.
I'm done rebuying things I've returned. I don't want
to. I just don't know if you saw it because it looked pretty good. Again, I don't know how well if maybe those little things lifted up. I'm trying.
I mean,
to
they
the...
seem to have a lot have better it, Dremel it. Skills than I have. So theirs looked a lot better than I think mine would. But
here it is, Omar Shaheen. Yeah. Yeah, it's looking pretty good. I mean, I don't know if those little pointy bits. I'll send you the link to it. I don't know if those little pointy bits might catch under your finger or whatever. But it just I immediately thought of that when you were talking about chopping up your things last time, and I forgot to mention it.
Yeah, I'm hoping the Suti leather case comes. Also, like what I'm also hoping to see. I don't know if this will exist because it seems like the market for like leather magnetically attached phone backs that don't have any side protection seems like a pretty small market.
I mean, it is kind of a weird thing. Like people usually buy cases for protection, not back grip, but
true. And I did try, I found some Amazon seller for like $7. They were selling this, some kind of like gel, back, like,
oh my,
like a stick on decal that you
like
stick
jelly
on the back.
Shoes for your phone.
It was horrific. I left a negative Amazon review, which I almost never do, but it was that bad. So that was not a good experience. I did have, for my Casey Goose trip, I did have just a cheap clear case from Toras, T-O-R-R-A-S, from Amazon. It was relatively inexpensive, I think, like under $20. And it's like a basic clear TPU case. No MagSafe support. So it does, you know, it did kind of ruin MagSafe's strength. But it was cheap, and it would come the next morning. So I tried it; it was fine. The only thing I don't like about the Toros clear case is that the lip around the camera plateau is very tall, and so which makes sense. Like it helps it stand off the table better, but it's really tall, and you don't really stop noticing that. And like it kind of protrudes and makes like an outline on your pocket in your jeans. Like you can see the rim around the camera mesa as its own outline, and I didn't love that. But
yeah,
can't
on
beat
that
the value.
Topic of the having tall rings around the mesa, I've seen a lot of people complaining about this, and I don't think people have thought it through. They're like, they made this big full width camera mesa plateau thing, but the cameras still stick out from it. So when I put it on the table, it still rocks because the cameras stick out, you know, more on the side where the three lenses are than the side that doesn't have any lenses. They're like, why didn't they just make it flat all the way across? If there was, first of all, the cameras are not sticking out just for the hell of it. That's how deep they are. That's what they can fit. There's the screen on the other side of them. Those are the cameras. Believe me, there is no empty space that they're wasting inside there. And given that, if you made the iconic plateau even with the tops of the camera lenses all the way across, that would look like this case that you're describing. It would be huge. Like, you don't realize how prominent that sort of five head would be, to borrow a phrase from the Flophouse. It would just be gigantic. And granted, they could probably put more stuff in there or whatever, but, like, I don't think you want that. Like, it's a shame that the camera lenses stick out as far as they do, but you don't want the whole plateau to be even with the tips of the cameras, because that would just be very top-heavy and weird and leave weird prints in your jeans.
Well, interesting that you mentioned that, though. There actually is a slightly better solution, but I'll get to that in a second. So I also tried John's favorite, the bull strap case with the open bottom. This is a nice leather case. I got the black one. It looks very nice on the phone. And with the open bottom, you still get to see the nice orange strip of your phone on the bottom, which I found to be a nice feature. I don't like the way bull strap partially covers up the camera mesa. I like when cases leave the mesa itself like the full round rect shape and don't try to like just leave the cameras open in a square and then have like, you know, the two holes for the two things on the right.
Although in this particular phone, because as we noted on an earlier episode, that sharp edge around the camera plateau is the place where the anodization will come off, and the bull strap case does protect that whole sharp edge with leather.
It does. And the bull strap, the way the case like rises up around that, it doesn't create any sharp or, like, you know, blunt edges.
Yeah, everything that's one of the things rounded. I like about my 16 Pro bull strap case is that the thing around the camera is kind of smooth and slanted and leather. It's not a plastic frame, a metal frame, a chamfered metal frame. You know, like, lots of cases do that, and I don't like feeling that in the back of the phone. I like it to be smooth up there. My wife's got the bull strap case, too, and I don't like how it looks when it covers that the full width plateau, but I do like the protection it provides and the fact that it's leather, like, in more places.
Yeah, honestly, it looks like a car bra. It really does. Like, going back to our very first podcast together, like, it looks exactly like a car bra.
But it has the opposite, because it will protect the thing under it instead of getting grit under there and causing abrasions and having it all.
Yeah, but it's I wish it was more open. But anyway, otherwise, the bull strap case is pretty nice. The leather feels fantastic. It's a great quality leather. Even like after only a couple days of use, it already feels amazing. The black, I think, is a really nice color combo with the orange. And overall, I'm very happy with the bull strap, except that the sleep-wake button is not a good button feel.
Yeah, the buttons aren't great this year on the bull strap case.
Yeah, that and that really hurts it. Like, it's the kind of thing, like, you know, you push sleep wake and like you think it pushed, but you don't really feel that click the way you do with a good button. So like double clicking it to like for Apple Pay or something, like, it feels awful.
You also might have a bad one. Like, there, I think the quality control on the buttons is variable, because again, the buttons on my bull strap case from the 16 Pro, they're okay. My wife's buttons, I think, are worse than mine, but they're still clicky. So, I mean, I don't think you want to return it or whatever. But like,
no, I don't want to go through that. But
their buttons, like, there's something I've heard about the Apple case. Was it the Apple cases? They said, like, the buttons are much improved this year or whatever, like the tech woven. Good buttons versus bad buttons, there's a wide gap with cases, and it's very difficult to tell what you're getting by looking at the pictures on the website.
Yeah, Apple tends to have the best buttons. Like, that's just the reality of their cases. Like, if you want...
Although the clear cases, like, the buttons on a clear Apple clear case compared to the buttons on an Apple, like the tech woven or fine woven, huge difference, because the clear case,
yes,
it kind
true.
Of has to be like all one thing, and they're not great.
That's true. Yeah, the clear case, it's not nearly as good as the others. But yeah, overall, bull strap, best looking case I've seen, best feeling leather I have found in a long time in a case, but the buttons are not amazing. Open bottom is great. Covered up plateau is less great. So it's kind of a mixed bag, but overall, a very strong showing. And then finally, I have, for the last few days, been using the Peak Design case. I got that in a couple days ago, so I've been trying that out. I've had great success with these in previous phones, and the Peak Design, if you've ever used the Peak Design phone case, it's the same case. It's like they just keep making the same thing over and over again, but that's a good thing. It's a good case. I really like the Peak Design case. There's a couple things about it that I don't, but mostly it's a very positive. So first of all, I think it looks fantastic. Like, this is the material that Tech Woven wishes it was, but it's not. I don't know why. But Peak Design's material, they have a couple of material choices. I still get like the gray one that has like the original like nice gray weave. The other choices are getting poor reviews, so I would say be careful with those. But if you get like the woven texture ones, it's the same old texture they've always had, and it's great. The rim around the camera plateau is a little bit pokey, but not nearly as bad as the cheap case, and it doesn't stick up quite as far overall, so it's overall like a nicer ratio for that. You do slightly see the outline in a pocket, but it's much more subtle. I love having the little square indentation on the back to kind of put your finger in as you're like resting the phone in your grip. It kind of serves as like an inverse pop socket in that way. It does have a covered up bottom, but it does not obstruct like the speakers in any meaningful way. You know, charging cables, even like the thick anchor cables, go in it just fine. The buttons feel great. Peak Design buttons are almost as good, maybe even as good as Apple's buttons. They're very, very good. They have a camera control button this year, which is also so did the bull strap, by the way. Both of those camera control buttons are very, very good. The Torres cheap clear case does not have a camera control button; it just has a cutout. But yeah, bull strap and Peak Design, great camera control buttons. They feel good. They're easy to push. They click in nicely. So overall, Peak Design is good. The main downside of the Peak Design case is that it's just bulky. And that's just their cases have always been this way. It's a trade-off. It is not super slim. It is not super lightweight. It does cover up most of the orange of the phone, although you do see the entire camera plateau, which is nice. So it's a mixed bag. The Peak Design case, it's like the mid-sized SUV of phone cases. Like it will take you anywhere you need to go. It is overall, if you're going to have one case on your phone all year round and you want it to be, relatively protective, you want it to be able to get wet unlike leather and still be okay, like the Peak Design case is a great choice.
Does it not have a lip around the screen that sticks out farther than the screen?
It does. It's not very tall. I mean, it's a pretty shallow.
I was just looking at some of the reviews and stuff for the older cases, and they're complaining that the lip isn't enough to essentially, like, if you put your phone face down, that your screen will actually be touching it, versus like the bull strap case, for instance, a grain of salt could very easily be on the table and not touch your screen if you put it screen face down in the bull strap case.
No, the Peak Design case, actually, I'll compare them for you. The Peak Design case, it does have a raised lip. It's not a very tall raised lip, but it definitely does have it. Here, I'll pop it into the bull strap now. Let's see.
Stop taking your phone and out of cases. You're upsetting me.
I get my phone to be used. I don't care if it gets like minor little
dust.
No, it's
every time you put it in and out of the case, you're risking, you're stretching out the case, you're making the fit worse, and you're risking probably.
I would say the bull strap is about the same depth. Maybe the bull strap might be a little bit taller ridge around it, but it's not a meaningful difference. But yeah, overall, I would say bull strap for formal occasions, Peak Design for general utility, and a cheap clear case if you want, clear view of the phone. But ultimately, I'm still waiting for a good leather back, and I still like, kind of more like minimal cases than these. But for now, this is good. The Peak Design also, for whatever it's worth, if you have any needs for a strong mount on something, like if you have like a bike, you want to mount your phone on your bike. Peak Design makes mounts like that and they latch in way stronger than magnets. They latch into like the hole in the back of the case, the square hole, and it's like a physical latching mechanism, so it's much stronger than anything magnetic. That being said, for whatever it's worth, the Peak Design case also has by far the strongest MagSafe strength I've ever seen in a case. Like, when you put this on the MagSafe puck, when you want to take it off the puck, you got to pull hard, which is actually really nice in a lot of cases. Like, I tried earlier in my car mount, I tried to like jiggle it off the car mount to see like, will it fall off a mount? And the entire mount moved before the phone did. Like, it's a very strong magnetic connection on the back of the Peak Design case, way more than the bull strap and any other case I've ever had, way more than the naked phone even. And so if that's a relevant thing to you, again, the Peak Design will probably win that comparison as well. So overall, it's a great overall case. It's just a bit bulky, but that's kind of the nature of it. And otherwise, it's very, very good.
Well, so you seem like you found at least a couple of winners.
Yeah, I mean, like last year, I'm probably going to change it up throughout the year as seasons and needs change. But overall, I'm happy with what I have found. But I do wish that my Suti leather back would ever ship.
I'm so sorry. For what it's worth, I got a considerable amount of amusement with Aaron and Marco tag teaming me on making fun of my blue phone and saying how much I should return it and get an orange phone.
Oh my God.
I stand by my blue phone. That's sometimes purple, but occasionally blue. I don't think I want an orange
phone.
Every
time Casey referred to the color of his phone on the trip, it was like kind of resignation and slight displeasure. And we're like, you're within the return window. You obviously don't like the color you picked. Just return it while you still can and get the one that you actually want.
Well, but I don't think I genuinely don't think I want the orange
phone. He just doesn't want to go through the phone transfer process again.
Also that. We also very much that. And I mean, there are definitely times where I really, really do like the look of this and the color of this. But I wish for a stronger, bolder blue. That's all. All right, let's talk iOS 26 first impressions. And John, it seems like you would like to start, so please do.
Because okay. I didn't run iOS 26. You two have had it, obviously, for your betas of your apps and everything like that. But I was avoiding it because I had heard terrible things about it. And, you know, I'm like, I'll wait till the release version.
Oh, quick update, by the way. The 26.1 Beta 2 and Tahoe Beta 2 have made tethering less broken.
Right.
It will once you connect now, it will stay connected. But the initial process of connecting now takes like three times longer because it can get into a state where the little circle next to the, you know, Marco's iPhone 17 Pro, like the tethering circle in the menu is lit up, but then the menu bar item still shows like no Wi-Fi, and you have to like deselect it and then reselect it for it to actually connect and make you connected to the tethering. So it's still a mess, but at least like once you are connected, at least it stays connected. So it's less broken, but still broken.
Cool. Yes,
I installed iOS 26 when the release one came out. I don't have the beta that Marco was just referring to it, and I'm not on the beta train. I'm just on the release train. So I'm running 26.0. And again, I've been using Tahoe since it was released in all the betas, so I'm familiar with how that looks, and I don't like it. And how it works, and I don't like it, but whatever, got to deal with it with my apps. But iOS 26, like I've seen all the screenshots, I'd heard you two talk about it, I heard Marco talk about it at length in his experiences with his apps and everything, but I didn't really quite know what to expect, other than I knew that I wasn't going to like how it looked, because I'd seen how it looked. So now having used it, I don't know, for a couple weeks now, here's the few additional things that I have to say about it on top of what you two have already said about it during the betas. To find at least two nice things to say about iOS 26.
Wow.
Okay. First, in previous versions of iOS, various things, especially in like top navigation and stuff like that, like the back button or like, you know, I don't know, the thing you hit to close a sheet or whatever, the touch areas may have been the same size as they are in 26, but 26, due to its different style where it draws, like if you have like an X button, it draws a circle around it, or if you have like a toolbar, it draws like an outline around it. The touch areas in iOS 26 look bigger. I don't know if they are bigger, but they look bigger because visually you used to have like the word back and a little left-facing chevron. And I'm sure the touch area for that was probably huge, but you didn't see that because you just saw like the background that it's on and you saw the text and you felt like you had to tap the text. And the text can be small, like the capital B is big, but the ACK are small. And you're like, do I have to hit that? No, like the touch area was probably huge, but it felt smaller. With the big actual outlines around buttons, like the big circle around the X or the big circle around a chevron or the big circular capsule shape around like a toolbar at the top or a checkbox or whatever, or a check mark or whatever, those touch targets feel bigger to me, and I like that. Number two, second nice thing. In earlier versions of iOS, in the post-iOS 7 era, when there was any kind of state change on touch, like you touch that back button, you touch the little X thing or whatever, it was pretty subtle. Maybe the word back would change from light blue to dark blue or some other kind of highlighting type thing. iOS 26, usually the entire background of the thing that you hit does some stupid glowy effect, right? But it's not, you won't miss it. Like, it's sitting there, and when you touch it, it like, I don't know if it's HDR lights up, but it like lights up and like this little transition and glow goes through it and there's an animation or whatever. But that happens as soon as you touch it. And imagine having things react to you activating them is a good thing in UI design. One of the things that we kind of sort of lost in the iOS 7 transition because that became so much more subtle. So those are my two nice things to say about iOS 26.
Oh, no.
The touch targets feel like they're bigger, even if they're not. And more things that are buttons-like in the UI make it clear when you hit them immediately. As soon as your finger hits them, they do their highlight thing. Everything else about it is what we've said before. And in particular, like I felt like doing a blog post about this because I feel like the three main sins of the 26 redesign, not just iOS, but across all the platforms, are like how it looks, like subjective stuff, which is like you might like it or you might not, but I don't. So that's just the subjective thing. Moving everything away from the edges, like, and you know, the whole like not having things go edge to edge and having them be inset in capsules and whatever the third one is that I put in my notes document that I can't remember now, but like, like those are like there are a few fundamental. Oh, and the third one I remembered immediately. Showing stuff through behind, you know, like I can, you know, why do I need to see through this control to the content that's behind it or whatever, right? Those are the three main sins, as far as I'm concerned, of the entire OS redesign. And we keep thinking, like, when they come out with the 20th anniversary phone or the folding phone with a wraparound edge-to-edge screen, this redesign will, quote-unquote, make sense. And I don't think that's true, because all you'd have to do is change the safe area insets with the old design, and it would make just as much sense. Like, it's no, you don't need them to be floating lozenges. You don't need to see the content through them. You don't need to see the content behind them. But, yeah, those are the three main things that I object to this entire OS design. I think it's ugly. Your mileage may vary, but just subjectively, I think it's not attractive. I think, in, you know, insetting everything off of the margins and making them floating and having to have margins around all the buttons wastes space and is bad. And the content that, and it makes problems with the content being able to be seen not underneath the controls, but around where there are no controls. And then finally, having the controls show content that's literally underneath them is a terrible mistake. And those are the three big ones. There's a lot of smaller nitpicks to pick, but nothing about using the iOS 26 has changed my mind about any of that. It's just as bad as I thought it would be. Much like Tahoe. Wow. Like I said about Tahoe, you get used to it. It's fine. Like, it's not a big deal. I said this from, like, day one on Tahoe. Like, I hate how it looks. I think it's incredibly stupid, but it's fine. You survive. It's not the end of the world. It could be worse, right? And this is coming from someone who doesn't even like how it looks. And I feel that way about iOS 26. Now, in iOS 26, I have been trying to, like, just leave it on the defaults. Because I didn't want to be like, oh, day one, I'm putting on reduced transparency. I'm putting on, like, I just want to use it like it shipped, just so I have a legit experience from it. And so far, I'm mostly sticking with that. There are all sorts of situations where things are legible on the screen. And, like, I basically got burned out on those before the thing actually shipped, because we've seen so many of them. But they're real. They come up. Like, in particular, the one that blew me away on day one was, like, if you take a screenshot on iOS 26... and then you look at that screenshot and the stupid Photos app with the stupid iOS 26 design, guess what? The screenshot, which is a picture of your phone screen that has, like, the time at the top on your battery, shows right underneath the actual time on your screen and the battery when the screenshot is shown full screen. And why? Because the Photos app has a completely transparent status bar that shows the photo underneath it. So you get to see the time. You get to see what the time was in the screenshot exactly superimposed on top of the actual time, and it just scrambles that whole top of the screen and looks ridiculous. Like, I can't even believe that they shipped something. This was so dumb. But in the grand scheme of things, when that happens, all you pinch and you can see what time it really is. And, you know, like, there are always ways around it. It's not the end of the world. It's fine. Your phone will be fine. And practically speaking, I still haven't turned on reduced transparency. I just deal with, because I think it looks even uglier with reduced transparency, honestly. I just deal with,
well,
the way
also,
it looks.
26.0 has some pretty bad bugs with reduced transparency, especially in dark mode.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I still continue to hear from customers every single day about. I cannot wait for 26.1 to be released to the public, as long as they fix tethering first. But yeah. I cannot wait.
Yeah, I wish they would fix these other obvious things that are just, like, fundamental to the design, but it's like, I don't know what they can do about it. But anyway, and then finally, on the sort of keeping the default front, there was lots of discussion on earlier episodes of you two going back and forth about the whatever compact toolbar in Safari at the bottom, right? Mm-hmm, you can have it be two stack and you get the immediate one-tap access back to your tabs and stuff like that. I've left it on the default just to see if I could tolerate it. And the answer is, yeah, I mostly can. I find myself using most often the double tap on the three dots button, which is a nice gesture. I think it seems like it might just be a consequence of, like, oh, actually, you're just catching the animation in the process. But I think they programmed that in. I think they made sure that a double tap, like, I don't think you're catching the in-transition animation of the pop-up menu. I think they're just registering a two-tap gesture and doing it. So I use double tap. Occasionally, you swipe up from the little bar thingy. And the reason I haven't gone to the two stack is because I don't want more. I don't want it eating into even more of my space. It's bad enough that I have that stupid useless area on the bottom where there's nothing. Then I have the floating toolbar. I don't want to waste more space with the second row. So yeah, I've been using stock iOS 26. I've been surviving. It's fine, except for all the parts where it's ridiculous and stupid. And I hope that someone comes in and changes this in the next 5 to 10 years.
Wow.
Cool. All right. So I was in Memphis when iOS 26 dropped, and I was around a bunch of ALSAC employees. Again, ALSAC, what is it? American, Lebanese, Syrian, something, something. I forget what it means. But anyways, it's a fundraising arm for St. Jude and Associated Charities. There you go. Anyway, so I would ask these like regular people, what do you think of iOS 26? And
did they have it on their phone, or you asked them to look at your phone?
No, their own phones. And I think, in fact, I think a lot of them had it pushed to their work devices, which they were not happy about. But anyways, for the most part, the reaction was not great. And the only consistent feedback I got that was specific was a lot of people really hated the way messages looked, particularly the lack of like a opaque bar at the top. And at least one or two people commented, and I have the same issue. A lot of times when I want to send a screenshot of a message's conversation, I want to send like a comment or two. Like, I don't need the whole damn conversation. And what I would do in iOS 18 is, if you're quick about it, you can scroll so that there's a big gap between the last message and the keyboard. And that would shove the last couple of messages all the way up to the top of the screen, right? And then you can take a screenshot and then crop that screenshot. So you've got the top of the screen, you've got the header and the navigation bar with who you're talking to, and then the last couple of text messages sent. And I do that oftentimes to call attention to the specific context I want, or maybe it's, you know, private information that I'm not trying to share above that. But I do this not infrequently. And that is effectively impossible now, because there is no top navigation bar in the same sense that there was in 18. And what's there is translucent. And there were a handful of people that really didn't like that. So then I get home. I transfer Erin's old phone to her new one, which means she's getting iOS 26. And the first thing she said to me is, "How in the name of Zeus's butthole do I close a tab in Safari?" Not her words, but you get the idea. How do I close a tab in Safari? And I explained, well, you know, they really rejiggered everything, and I tried it for a few days. I couldn't handle it. I really did give it an honest thought, but I couldn't handle it. And so I went back. To the best of my knowledge, she hasn't yet, which probably relates to the fact that she has about 11 billion tabs on her phone. It drives me bananas, but it works for her. But the one positive feedback that she gave me, most of it, she was like, meh, whatever. But the positive bit of feedback she gave me, which I am also enjoying, but I think she's gotten genuinely quite a lot of love out of, is being able to see typing indicators in group text. Because it used to be you could see a typing indicator when one-to-one chats, including in RCS, but you can now get that in group chats on iMessage. And she was really, really into that. And I thought that was interesting. So that's my feedback. Has Tiff had anything interesting or worthwhile to note about it?
No, she's basically been like, it's fine, whatever.
Yeah, fair my enough. Kids haven't gotten it yet, but they're going to get it with their new phone, so it'll be interesting to see what they think. Mm-hmm. Because, again, like I said, my daughter, when I put Tahoe on, quote-unquote, her laptop, which is not really hers,
wow,
she did not like it. She was like, no, don't want. I'm like, all right, well, you know, then she's got a new laptop now that doesn't have Tahoe on it. I had both my kids turn off auto updates before Tahoe came out, because they both expressed that they did not want it. So now they don't have to get it. Eventually they probably will. But anyway, I bet they'll probably be fine with it on their phone. But my daughter has complaints about a lot of things, but eventually she gets over it. It's just, like I said, this is a blog post that I almost made like three times. So just those three things that apparently I need to write better in my notes document, of just like how it looks. I think it's ugly. Moving things in from the edges, and the fact that you can see through stuff. And those are just the three, like, top three sins of this design. And they spread to all the OSs, and they're bad ideas. They're just bad ideas. And we get to deal with them everywhere. And, I mean, obviously, look, if you like the look, it's two bad ideas, right? But for me, it's three, because I don't like how it looks.
All right, tell me about iPad OS 26.1, John.
I'm even more wary about the other OSs. Obviously, like with the iPad, I mentioned when we were talking about the betas, like, oh, slideover is gone. That's like my main use case for using my iPad, as I watch full screen video, because it's like my little bedtime TV. I watch full screen video, and then I have social media apps and slideover. I'm watching like some, you know, thing that I don't need to pay tons of attention to, like some crappy reality TV. And I have stuff in slideover. Slideover, like my normal slideover apps I have these days are Slack, Ivory, and Tapestry. Tapestry is the thing I use to read Blue Sky most of the time. And it's nice. I got full screen video. When I want to see something in SlideOver, I slide it over. And if you swipe at the bottom of a SlideOver thing, you can cycle through which thing you're seeing in SlideOver. So I can rotate through those things that I just said. With the SlideOver staying there, it just goes like a little bunch of cards. One, two, three, it just goes around in a cycle. Swipe, 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 swipe. And when you're done with the SlideOver, you just chuck it. You can flick the SlideOver to the other side of the screen if you want on the left instead of the right. You can hide it. That's SlideOver. And I heard that iPadOS 26 doesn't have it. I'm like, I'm all, you know, I don't, the windowing features are not for me. Like, I don't use my iPad in that way, but I'm like, I don't mind them. It should all be fine. But I want my SlideOver. So everyone was all excited when iPadOS 26.1 beta came out. They said, SlideOver's back! SlideOver's back in iPadOS 26.1! Everyone's so excited about it. And so I foolishly updated from 18 to 26.1 beta just to get SlideOver. And I think that they did a bad job.
Aww.
Oh, no.
What happened?
Well, so first of all, the thing that everybody knows is now you can only have one app in SlideOver, which doesn't make any sense to me. Because like I said when we talked about iPadOS 26, SlideOver fits perfectly with the windowing system of iPad 26. It's just another way of dealing with windows. It makes your windows tall and skinny, and it puts them off to the side where you can't see them. And when you swipe in from the edge, they come. And when you cycle through it, like, it fits perfectly. There's tons of other things you do with windows and windowing mode on iPad that are just like that. This is just another one. It's just another place where you can make windows. You know, you got Stage Manager, you got the windowing thing, you got all sorts of ways to deal with windows on iPad, and this fits the paradigm perfectly. It doesn't require the windows to be anything but what they are. It's just an automated way to have them off-screen and then on-screen and cycle through them. But they said, no, you can only have one of these in 26.1 beta. I don't know why, but that's what they did. Second, they put a translucent sort of liquid glass, whatever, outline around the thing. Pretty big, like half a centimeter outline around the thing to indicate that it's not like other windows, like it's going to behave differently, you know. At least I'm guessing that's what it's for. So you don't think it's just a regular window because it behaves like a SlideOver window. You can gesture to chuck it off the screen. You can gesture to pull it on. That's not true of other windows. It's true of SlideOver. Fine. It's an affordance. Didn't need to be there before, but I don't object to it at all. The real thing they screwed up, well, a couple of things. One, if you remember the original iPhone, one of the cool features they had, and it's still there to this day, is if you're doing something like, say, scrolling a web page, if, especially back in the olden days of the original iPhone, not a lot of websites were updated for mobile, as they say. They were just regular websites that would render on your iPhone, and sometimes the text would be real small, and you'd pinch a zoom, blah, 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 but they weren't like sort of mobile savvy. Yeah, exactly. I said I needed a website to test this on, and I immediately went to Daring Fireball. Sorry, John.
There it is.
Because he hasn't updated his website. And here's the key thing. When you have a sort of a non-mobile savvy website or any kind of content on your phone screen that you can scroll up and down and left and right. There's more to the left, there's more to the right, there's more up, there's more down. This can be an image, this can be whatever, but very often non-mobile savvy web pages are like this, right? But what the iPhone would do from day one is if it sensed that you were trying to scroll vertically, it would lock you into like a rail vertically. And even if as you started scrolling vertically, your finger went off to the left or your finger drifted right a little bit, the content wouldn't go off to the left or drift right. It would be like it was stuck on a rail. It's like, you're vertically scrolling. I'm not going to make you carefully, perfectly move your finger in a straight line down the screen. I'm going to let you, once I realize you're vertically scrolling, I'm going to lock it in there and just makes it much, we'd take it for granted, but this is a thing about the iPhone. If you've ever noticed this before, go load Daring Fireball and try it out. As soon as it figures out you're going up and down, it locks you into that. And so even if you move your thumb side to side, it won't do that. SlideOver, 26.1 beta, miraculously undoes this. Because when you try to chuck the SlideOver thing back off the screen, you're like, why is the thing moving up and down? It exactly tracks my finger. I'm trying to, like, old SlideOver, when you chucked it, it would be like, oh, I see you're trying to dismiss that. And it would move it exactly to the right, exactly east, right? Or exactly west. And the current one tracks your finger. So it looks like it's all loosey-goosey. And it's like, it's going up and down and up. It's like, that's stupid. Like, how could they screw that up? And then on top of that, in my context where I'm watching full screen video and sliding a thing over and back, first of all, when I swipe it in from the edge of the screen, it doesn't slide in from the edge. It like fades into its final position. Like, what the hell? It's called SlideOver. Slide it over, people. Like, just slide it from the side. It like cross fades into its final position. And then it makes the full screen, like it has a full screen flash of both windows, like a flicker, like a one frame flicker flash when the thing comes in. Like I brought my iPad to just try this out because like it's so maddening to me that it, like that they managed to screw this. Like I should slow mo it because I think it like it half animates but then fades into the final position. And if you're playing video, it makes the whole screen flicker every time it comes in and out. Now, granted, this is a beta. Maybe they'll fix this stuff. I'm like, how do you screw up slide over so badly? It's a feature you already had that you could have taken exactly as is and put it into the OS. And somehow they found a way to make it less useful and screw it up in every possible detail. Oh, and then the final thing is, and this is not the fault of iPadOS 26, I guess, but lots of the apps I use don't understand iOS 26 windowing system. So, for example, in Ivory, if you swipe left and right and like the toolbar on the top of the thing, you can change accounts. But when you're in iPadOS, the windowing system grabs that swipe and thinks you're chucking the window to the left. Cool. That's not what you're trying to do. In Tapestry, when you tap a link in a thing and it brings up like an in-app browser sheet type thing, and you dismiss that sheet by hitting the big X in the upper or whatever to dismiss like the web view sheet thing, it dismisses the web view, but it also registers it as a tap on top of the timeline and scrolls you immediately to the top. Because of the confusion about who is controlling what safe area inset or whatever, these are a combination of like apps not being updated for iOS 26 and beta bugs and stuff like that. But the overall experience is that the thing I was trying to avoid, I did to myself. I feel like Casey. I was trying to avoid messing with my workflow of like watching full screen video and having apps and slide over, and I messed with it in every possible way because now I'm constantly accidentally scrolling Tapestry all the way to the top and having to use the jump back button. I'm sliding things in and out and having the screen flicker every time it happens. I'm being distracted by the fact that the thing is wobbling up and down as I move it in and out. I'm being annoyed every time the fade animation comes in, and I'm being annoyed about that big outline. I don't know how they managed this. It was an existing feature, but they re-implemented it poorly with fewer features. So it's better than not having it. Like, I'm sorry, it's better than not having it, but I kind of regret upgrading.
Wow.
So other than that, did you like the play, Mrs. Lincoln?
I mean, and if you think of how I use my iPad, what else am I getting out of iPadOS 26? Like, I'm not a power user of iPad. I got this thing for the freaking OLED screen so I could watch TV on it and also have Slack and Ivory and Tapestry. And it's kind of sad, but, you know, I will endure.
I'm glad. All right. Hello, Future Marco. Hi. How far are we in? An hour and 40 minutes. I would say maybe we shelve Tahoe for now and maybe even shelve Iceblock, even though people are going to be mad about it. We could tease it if you want, but because I mean, Iceblock's
going to be long as an after show if you want.
It's really rough as an after show.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's better to put it there.
I
feel like we still have time to do it as a topic. We'll just have to do faster after show.
Okay.
Yeah, all right.
All right. I would definitely shelving Tahoe then, and we're going to miss Ask ATP, but that's fine.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's do our darndest to try to not drone on for 16 hours. Okay.
Us?
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I put all this stuff in here. I feel like when we go through all this stuff, that will cover a lot of the facts, I feel like, and will save us some time. And as long as we don't repeat things that we've said previously or at least summarize them, it could be shorter.
All right, let's give it a shot.
Good luck.
In just 1 second. All right, goodbye, Future Marco.
Bye.
All right, so we have more first impressions to talk about. We're going to have to shelve that because there's been some news this week. Apple has pulled Iceblock from the App Store. Richard Lawler at The Verge writes, Apple has removed the Iceblock app from its App Store. The Iceblock app is intended to be used anonymously to report sightings of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, officials, and see sightings reported within a five-mile radius. Iceblock rose to the top of the App Store's charts this summer after being targeted by Trump administration officials, with U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem calling it an obstruction of justice, and Attorney General Pam Bondi claiming it was not a protected speech. On October 2nd, Bondi took credit for the app's removal, saying to Fox News Digital, "We reached out to Apple today, demanding they remove the Iceblock app from their app store, and Apple did so. Iceblock is designed to put ICE agents at risk just for doing their jobs, and violence against law enforcement is an intolerable red line that cannot be crossed." Excuse me while I pick up my eyes, which have just rolled out of my head.
Oh, I'm going to have a lot to say about this.
No, we have to be quick. It'll be fine. Don't worry. IceBlock developer Joshua Aaron is quoted in the same report as saying it counts over 1.1 million users and that Apple has claimed they received information from law enforcement that IceBlock served to harm law enforcement officers. This is patently false.
Yeah.
Apple made similar claims in 2019 when it removed HK Map, an app that allowed Hong Kong protesters to trace the movements of law enforcement, with CEO Tim Cook telling employees that over the past several days, we received credible information from the Hong Kong Cybersecurity and Technology Crime Bureau, as well as from users in Hong Kong, that the app was being used maliciously to target individual officers for violence and to victimize individuals and property where no police are present. At the time, lawmakers from both sides of the aisle spoke out against Apple's censorship of apps. A letter signed by four Republican and three Democratic members of Congress, including Cruz and AOC, if I'm not mistaken, said cases like these raise real concern about whether Apple and other large U.S. corporate entities will bow to growing Chinese demands rather than lose access to a billion Chinese consumers. You know what would be great? It would be really great if we had an alternative way of getting apps on our phones. But
let's just get through this before we do the commentary. But yes, it's true.
Reuters says Apple removed more than 1,700 apps from its app store in 2024 in response to government demands, but the vast majority, more than 1,300, came from China, followed by Russia with 171, South Korea with 79. Over the last 3 years, the United States has not appeared as one of the countries where apps were removed due to government demands, according to the company Application Transparency Reports. MJ Tsai writes, back in 2011, a group of Democratic senators asked Apple to remove DUI checkpoint apps from the App Store. Apple's position at the time was that these apps were a net positive in terms of public safety. Then the government brought the Apple VP of Software Technology, Bud Tribble, before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee, where Senator Schumer demanded and Senator Udall lambasted, and Apple changed its mind and banned the apps. Cool.
So this last bit of context here. So the Verge story is like, here's the deal. Here's what people said about it with the IceBlock app. I think the Reuters and MJ Tsai story provided some important context, in particular that 1,700 apps were banned in 2024 due to government responses. Like, government asked Apple to pull an app, and they did, and they said yes 1,700 times. Again, most of them from China, followed by Russia, and that the U.S. was not on that list. But then MJ Tsai points out, actually, the U.S. has made Apple pull down an apps, and it was kind of similar, like law enforcement related, to remove DUI checkpoint apps. You remember that happened back in 2011? These are apps that would tell you, like, here's a place where police are checking for drunk drivers, and you could note them. And, you know, again, Democrats and Republicans asked Apple, you need to pull these apps. Apple hadn't pulled them, even though people had asked them to, and then they brought them in front of the Congress, and they said, you got to do this, and eventually Apple pulled the apps, right? And obviously the HK map one is very similar, like tracking protests or whatever, again, to law enforcement related. So I feel like the story here is that Apple has always been pulling apps when governments ask them to, but usually those governments are China and Russia. And it has happened once or twice with the U.S. when it's related to law enforcement, but now it's happening again with an app that very much looks like a law enforcement type app, you know, knowing where ICE is or whatever. And before we go wandering off into IceBlock and the current context, which is much more dire for us than the DUI checkpoint time was in 2011, let's say, but actually is very similar, I do want to say that this whole thing is a good example of the limits of Apple's strategy. Because Apple's strategy with the Trump administration both times has been essentially appeasement. Try to make nice with them. Try to make them not mad at you. Because when they're mad at you, they are, you know, it's a corrupt administration, and they will do things to harm your company individually in a vindictive way because they're just, you know, mobsters and bullies, right? They will specifically hurt your company, and we want them specifically not hurt our company, so we're working within a corrupt system to try to get favors, blah, blah, blah. The problem with that strategy is the strategy is not to make them mad. And you can blow that whole strategy. Appeasement stops working and becomes pointless the second you push back at all and make them mad at you. Because then it's like, well, what did you do all that appeasement for? So it leads to, like, the sunk cost fallacy of saying, well, we already made nice with all these things. We already did all this stuff. When they ask us to pull the IceBlock app, if we say no, they'll be mad at us. And it's like, well, then what did we do all that appeasement for? What did we sell our souls for before? And so you're inclined to say yes, and say yes to the next thing, and say yes to the next thing. And it's a slippery slope of appeasement. The word comes up in the context of World War II all the time. Appeasement looks great right up until you have the rise of Hitler, and then doesn't look so good anymore, does it? Because you're like, anyone who was on board with that appeasement thing tends to look bad in the eye of history of saying, you were appeasing this monster. And you're like, well, when I was appeasing them, they weren't really that monstrous. They were just on their way to monstrous, and I kept appeasing them. But eventually I found my limit, and Apple apparently has not found its limit. And it's not just the fact that we have a terrible, corrupt administration now. Again, in 2011, the situation was different. It was still, Apple was still making the same calculus. Oh, the government wants us to do this thing. We don't really care one way or the other. We'll probably get bad press from this if we say it's helping people to drunk drive. So we'll do this, but we'll still leave the speed, the speed radar checkpoint things in the Apple Maps app. Like, they didn't get rid of that, but DUI is over the line. Like, they're always doing this very cynical corporate calculus of, if there's too much public or government pressure to get rid of an app in the App Store, we'll do it. In the end, we control it and it's our decision, but we will do it. And devoid of any context, I feel like the IceBlock app feels exactly like that. It's like, oh, some government thing doesn't want us to have a thing, and we're harming law enforcement, or so they say, or they lie about everything, but half the country believes them anyway, so whatever, we'll just get rid of it and it'll be fine. But that's missing the wider context, which I'm sure Marco will get to in a second, which is 2025 is not 2011. Mm-hmm. The current administration is not what it used to be, and appeasement in this scenario, even though it has been Apple strategy from day one, it has its limits, and Apple so far has not found that limit for them. But I think a lot of their observers have said, you need to just get over the sunk cost fallacy and give up on the appeasement strategy and throw away all the stuff that you've done and screw your whole company over. Because if you keep down this path of just always saying yes and always agreeing, that's not going to lead anywhere good. Like, we all hope that they're going to find a line somewhere, but every time something like this happens, people like Marco flip out justifiably and say, I guess there is no line. I guess there's literally nothing that they can ask for that they won't do. It's not that, again, not removing IceBlock is not the biggest thing in the world, but it's like, you just start extrapolating. Well, what if they ask for this? What if they ask for that? Because again, the appeasement strategy requires you to not make them mad, and saying no to them will make them mad, which means you will say yes to anything. Marco, please go.
Okay.
Understanding, right. I would like to go to bed at some point tonight.
I'm going to go, and you're going to have to bear with me here. So this entire premise is predicated on a lie. It's predicated on the idea that they had to remove this app because it was dangerous to law enforcement. That is a straight-up lie. You know, if you think about, okay, what unreasonable danger is posed to ICE's, they use the term officials, I would use the term kidnappers and murderers. What unreasonable danger is posed to ICE's kidnappers and murderers by people telling other people where they are? They're the ones that have the guns, zero accountability, and the complete support of a fascist federal government behind them. They are kidnapping and murdering U.S. citizens, and we are supposed to believe that they are the ones that need protection from people knowing where they are. ICE agents, just like Donald Trump himself, are pathetic, weak, thin-skinned racists who only know how to demonstrate strength with cruelty, violence, and punching down. They are cowards, and they hide their cowardly faces behind masks because the only real danger they face is cameras. And they're such cowards, they can't even handle that. Now, just like when racists twisted Black Lives Matter into Blue Lives Matter and All Lives Matter, the idea that the ICE agents are the victims in need of protection from the people they're assaulting and killing is a dangerous lie. And that lie will be used to justify using more deadly force in retaliation. And Apple is now complicit in that lie. And the context of this is very important. The Trump administration is literally waging war on America, on Americans. This is not a metaphor. They are waging war against U.S. law, the U.S. Constitution, and U.S. citizens in the U.S. They are deploying military troops intentionally into liberal cities that will probably result in them shooting liberals. And now, this might sound like an exaggeration, but if this does, ask, say, your parents, if you're maybe under age, 50 or so, or ask Neil Young, what happens when a thin-skinned Republican president does deplorable things, and then when people start protesting, they deploy National Guard soldiers against them? This is going to escalate. people have already died, a lot more people will probably die as this escalates. And Apple, in this war against Americans on American soil, has chosen not only to not fight against it, but to explicitly and repeatedly support the aggressors of this war. Tim Cook's legacy will forever be tarnished by his Trump support. And not only is he destroying Apple's brand and reputation by doing this, he's supporting the destruction of our democracy and our home country. Tim Cook has shown us exactly who and what he is. He is cowardly, spineless, and I would say at this point, irredeemable. But there are other people, powerful people at Apple, who can still make a difference. So Tim Cook is a lost cause. We know he has shown us who he is. Believe him. I urge the rest of Apple's senior leadership to do some serious soul searching right now and consider what they're willing to support, what they want their careers and legacies to mean, and what they would like to tell their grandchildren in the future about how they handled what's going on in America right now with the power they had. Please, Apple leadership, really do some soul searching and consider how you want this to end.
It's pretty concise. I disagree with a lot of your more extreme statements there, but the gist is that I think we're all more or less on board with. Like, the lie that they're perpetrating does have a foundation in plausibility, which is like, in theory, knowing where law enforcement are located could cause them to come to harm, because now people who are trying to harm them know where they are and can ambush them and so on and so forth. In practice, has that happened? No, not to my knowledge. So it's just a theoretical thing that could happen. It's the same thing with the Hong Kong protesters, like trying to avoid the armed forces or whatever. It's like, yeah, you're picking a side. You're picking the side of law enforcement saying, we don't want people to know where we are through aid of this app, despite the fact that in our country anyway, it's perfectly legal to take pictures of police in public and so on and so forth. Still, the story that our government says to Apple is like, Apple even says they told us that law enforcement officers are coming to harm because of this. Could it have happened? Maybe, but our government lies so much about everything routinely all the time. Like, look at all the court cases. They just straight up lie. ICE in particular lies like crazy. Again, as proven in court multiple times, it's hard to take anything they say as truth, but in theory it could happen. So like, the issue is actually somewhat nuanced, kind of like the DUI checkpoint things. Like, do you want people evading DUI checkpoints when they're drunk? Probably not. As Casey pointed out earlier, this whole thing is a problem caused by Apple being the only way you can get apps, because if Apple wasn't the only way, fine, let them ban whatever they want. We'll just get it from an alternative app store. But that's not the world we live in, at least in this country. It's problems on top of problems on top of problems. And like, the appeasement strategy, like, it's essentially a trap. Like, it works fine right up until it doesn't. But when it doesn't, it negates everything you've done. It's like, well, what was the point in all of that? What was the point in all the harm that we caused if it turns out that the strategy is not sustainable? And I really feel like the strategy is not sustainable at this point. Like, it's just, it's not the fact that they pulled an app. That's not the thing. It's everything that Marco said, that what's happening with ICE in this country is just very, very bad. It's very bad. It's not like the DUI checkpoints, nothing like this was happening in that context. So it's like, oh, Apple pulls an app, it's kind of crappy, but whatever. And now it's like, okay, well, Apple pulling the app is part of what? Part of a thing that is happening that is terrible and is just getting worse by the day. I'm a little bit more optimistic than you are, Marco, that I'm hoping that the people wearing dinosaur suits in Portland will actually not get themselves shot and killed by ICE, but you never know what's going to happen. So I'm hoping that ridicule and peaceful protest and we'll keep this from escalating, because I'm hoping that our side is not going to escalate this, because honestly, like, the premise of all this of sending the National Guard into cities is like, the cities are war zones, everyone's dying, which is obviously not true, but part of the whole fascist thing is you just make up lies, get enough people to believe it, and then you send in troops, and then the troops cause violence to happen, and they say, see, look, we told you there was violence, and it's a terrible thing, but hopefully people know that that's what's happening and can do things like dressing up in silly outfits to combat it. But anyway, it's grim, and Apple is not helping.
I hope you are more right than I am. I don't think you will be, but I hope you are.
Yeah, we'll see. Like, you really can't tell how these things are going to go. But like, for people who are in positions to influence it, like, obviously individual citizens protesting and voting and so on and so forth, but like in positions of power like Apple or any of the other companies that are, or universities or any other of the large institutions in our country that are being, you know, that the government has essentially captured with this appeasement as the path of least resistance strategy, they can actually make an even bigger difference. And it's sometimes heartening to see like a couple of universities actually standing up for themselves, but it's incredibly disheartening to see Apple and all the tech companies and Columbia University and all the other things that just have folded like a house of cards and are not pushing back. And like I said, it's because the second they push back, they are self-negating their entire, you know, 9 month long appeasement strategy. And that's going to feel bad for them. It's a sunk cost fallacy, but they probably need to just get over it.
Yeah. And also, I think at this point, it is very clear that Apple needs to, at this point, recognize what they are and stop quoting Martin Luther King on their homepage. And also, yeah. I would say other people who would have pretty strong opinions about what they're doing right now, stop quoting them too, including Steve Jobs. They should never quote Steve Jobs again on their homepage if they're going to act like this. Because a lot of people say, what would Steve do? And a lot of times it's wishful thinking. Steve would not do this. He was a hippie. He was there. He would do a lot of things for the shameless, you know, seeking of money and success. He would not do this.
I don't know. People get old. He did do that thing with like colluding to not let people change jobs for more money with like Pixar and everything. That's pretty close to this.
Again, not great. Like he did a lot of not great things and had a lot of not great opinions, and he was a master BS artist to try to rationalize what he was doing. But he would not do this.
Well, anyway, what we really got to be hoping for is what the next CEO will do. And Steve's not going to be the next CEO, and neither is Tim. So, fingers crossed.
That transition cannot happen soon enough.
Did you see the recent story they're talking about all the like the Jeff Williams leaving and stuff like that? And Gurman had a bunch on it, and it was mentioning like if Tim leaves, he might still be chairman of the board. I'm like, no, Tim, just go to an island. Do not stay on as chairman of the board, please.
I mean, at least it would be step one. Like step one is get out of the CEO role.
I know, but like,
you know,
just,
I know obviously he's going to be around for a while.
Yeah, not to turn this to a succession topic, but like part of one of the things that Tim had, a quote unquote problem that Tim had, is just the long shadow of Steve Jobs. So for like his first few years, it was like he was steering the Steve Jobs ship, and that didn't let him become his own CEO, which, you know, for better or for worse, and we would say for worse at this point, right?
Yeah.
But like, I'm so afraid that like the next CEO will feel like they have to like be steering the Tim Cook ship for the first 2 years. Like, no, like that's why I want him to get it. I don't want him to be on the board. I don't want him to be there looking over anyone's shoulder. I want the new CEO to say, I'm the new CEO. I have different ideas. Clean break from the past. But I'm not sure that that's going to happen.
I mean, we'll see. Like, you know, the recent reigniting of the rumors that John Ternus might be the one kind of, you know, slated up in line next. You know, we don't know that much about John Ternus in ways like this. Like, we don't know, like, what kind of CEO he would be. But so far, like, honestly, like, if you look at, you know, look at what at Apple is working really well and what could use some help. Hardware is going really well. Like,
but the hardware
so,
is
know,
not, there's nothing, not much political in the hardware. So it's hard to
thing,
tell
yeah.
where he stands on that stuff, you know?
Yeah, like that, like we don't really, we won't know that unless we actually, you know, have that yeah. situation. And see
and
how
that's
it
the worst. That's the worst thing about like the second and third level of the org chart in Apple. You almost have no idea what the hell they're thinking because everyone speaks with one voice and is so aligned on the message. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like when you're electing politicians, you just hope that like, this politician did what it took to get elected, but once they get in there, they're going to do all this great stuff. Almost never happens. Like, because to yeah. get that far, to become the senior vice president at Apple, you have to be so willing to, you know, be on message and be aligned with the leadership that are you ever going to get somebody who spends all those years working all the way up, but in their secret heart is like, once when I get in charge, I'm going to change everything. No, I feel like you don't. Like you breed, like the only way you get that close, the only way you get to be second in line or whatever is to be like, to essentially just drink the Kool-Aid and be like, yep, no, I agree with all these Apple things. And just, that's, and with, like Ternus is just a cipher in this because, you know, again, in hardware, you don't spend a lot of time having to make any kind of decisions that touch this at all because it's like it's microchips and like, I mean, I guess maybe like sourcing parts and like sweatshops and stuff like that. But even that is more of like a Jeff Williams type thing. And anyway, I'm ready for it to be an uncertain future. I'm kind of over the present.
I mean, it's an I think it's an uncertain future now. Like, we, you know, we don't know.
I'm ready to be in the uncertain future. Like, I'm ready to be like in like, oh, there's someone new and I don't know what they're going to do because I know what the current people are going to do and it's not good.
Yeah. I mean, like, we need a lot of turnover right now in a lot of different ways.
That's what the Gurman story is about that we're referring to. That, like, all the, you know, Jeff Williams, I think we mentioned this on the show ages ago when it happened, like, bringing his second in command up and he's on his way out the door. And lots of people are kind of that age in senior leadership where they're going to retire within the next few years, including Tim Cook, we all hope. And so there could actually start to be some turnover at the top level of the company, which is an incredibly dangerous situation. Things could go terribly wrong, but it's also your only possible hope for, you know, positive change.
It just sucks. It all sucks. Everything sucks from top to bottom. And I feel like it is, I'm casting about trying to find something to be excited about, something to feel like, yes, this group or this person or these people, they get it. And they're fighting for the same thing that I am, to whatever degree I'm fighting for. And I feel like I've yet to find that person.
They're just losing all the time.
I guess.
That's why if you like follow all the court cases, you can enjoy all the lower court decisions before the Supreme Court overrules them all and says Trump can do whatever he wants. So if you can just enjoy the in-between period after they win decisively in the lower courts and you get to read those court decisions where they just take the government to task for being terrible, you know, just bad all over, and then just don't pay attention as it wanders up to the Supreme Court and they say, no, actually, it's fine.
Well, let me tell you, I'm sure the Democrats are fighting tooth and nail. Oh, never mind. No, they're not.
Some of them are, but most of them.
Like, I at this point, it's like, I love that everybody has the quaint idea that the courts are going to save us. Look at how much they have saved us so far. That's not going to happen. They're not going to save us. The courts won't save us, and the Democrats won't save us. So, you know, keep looking.
Well, the court. The Supreme Court won't save us. The lower courts, the government's losing all the time because they're wrong and breaking the law.
Yes, but then when it gets to the Supreme Court, they're going to win again. Like,
yes, that's right. So like, just enjoy
will
that brief
not
period
save us.
Between those two things.
You know, look, the entire first Trump era was defined by, you know, like, you know, Max's old joke, like, this time we got him this time, and like we never are going to get him. That's it.
If you want to get him this time, you've got to be rooting for heart disease.
Yeah, like nothing will ever get him. Like, that's
except for heart disease.
We can all pray for that, but nothing else will get him, and nothing else will stop him. And you know, if you think this is all going to be over in 3 years, I got news for you about that too. Like, I wouldn't necessarily count on that either. Until time saves us all, that's you know, don't count on anything coming to save us. Anyway, what a great show. Thanks for listening.
See, this would have been fine as an after show.
No, you can't end on that. It's terrible. We'll have the after show to pick us back up. Thank you to our sponsors this week, Squarespace, Delete Me, and Open Case. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about the new Meta Ray-Ban Display glasses and Apple's changing plans in response to that. You can join to listen at atp.fm/join. Thank you very much, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.
So this after show is going to be potentially fun for Marco and I and real sad for one of us.
Oh, no.
There's only one left. John, news broke over the last, I don't know, 24, 48 hours as we record this, that TiVo is exiting its legacy DVR business. Oh, you're going to have to wake up and join the 2020s. What are you going to do?
No, this is not really sad for me because, look, TiVo, I'm proud of TiVo for living as long as it has.
Yeah.
Because it's been a while. Like, TiVo, kind of like a couple other companies that I've previously enjoyed, like, they lost the ability to make good products several years ago. It's the reason I'm still running older TiVos. Because they're literally better spec-wise than the stuff they were selling. Like, they stopped selling DVRs that had the hard drive capacity of the one that I bought ages ago. They just, like, made them smaller and worse and put smaller diameter, noisier fans in them, and crappier hard drives. And just their products got worse, right? Even as technology marched on. And they never really made the transition to the 4K era, mostly because cable car didn't make a transition to the 4K era. Like,
That's not true.
Time has passed them by.
We have 4K cable cards? That's a thing?
Yeah, I'm almost sure of it because I get 4K from my cable card powered HD home run. I might be wrong, but I'm almost.
No, I think we went
right
through this when we did like the HD home run thing. Like that, it's not the cable card. It's the problem. Remember, I was saying like the only channels I get in 4K are like when they have those Red Sox games locally every once in a while, but everything else is 1080.
Oh, that is 100% true.
Yeah. That's basically what I mean. Like their idea was they would take quote unquote cable television and record it to a hard drive, and if the cable television is 1080, but you can get 4K on Netflix, you know. But anyway, the streaming area obviously came and passed them by, like you know. And I, even though I still have TiVo's connection to both of my televisions, I have a good one on my downstairs TV and a not so good one on my upstairs TV. You know, our viewing has just basically transitioned away from them almost entirely, almost but not quite entirely, to streaming services. So I mentioned this ages ago that I got rid of HBO on my cable plan and just subscribed to it in the streaming app because the streaming app had higher resolution, right? You know, streaming has come and displaced TiVo. And so it is kind of amazing that they've lasted as long as they can. It is also a shame that as this transition happened, they lost the ability to make good products. They could have done more of like a transition into like a more niche consumer product type thing. But like, again, they're constrained by the fact that the television coming to the house, either over the air or through cable, lost the spec race to the television coming into your house through streaming services. Because streaming services just went to 4K faster and higher bit rates and HDR, and cable was still jamming lots of channels over a single wire and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, time marches on. I still have my TiVos. I'm still running them. I still will continue to run them. I still pay for quote-unquote cable television, and I get stuff on there. But these days, for example, when I'm watching the Super Bowl or something, when that's on, rather than just going directly to TiVo and watching the Super Bowl, I'll check if it is in higher resolution on a streaming service somewhere, just to try to get a better version of the Super Bowl. The answer is usually it's not. It's usually basically the same because sports is still kind of behind the times for a variety of reasons. But anyway, so yeah, TiVo is no longer making a thing with hard drives and computers that will record cable television to the hard drive and let you play it back later. But I do want to say, and I'm pouring one out for TiVo, even though I don't drink, is that the original TiVo back before high-definition television was just, you know, standard-definition cable television, analog cable television coming over a cable, going into a cable card that was stuck into one of these things that had a computer and a hard drive in it, was one of the best consumer electronic products ever made, both in terms of how good it was at doing its job, but also in terms of how it changed the lives of people who had it. It's not iPhone caliber. Obviously, it didn't take the world by storm because it was kind of geeky, but like the way, I mean, if you talk to anybody who was around back then and got one of the early TiVos, the way it changed your relationship with television is actually analogous to the way streaming services have changed the way that everybody deals with television. Because it lets you, you know, let you pause live TV, lets you record multiple shows without using VHS tapes, lets you fast forward and rewind and skip commercials, which is the big thing that changed everyone's lives, right? And eventually it's recording six shows at once, which is a thing only the people with like 17 stacked VCRs used to do, and then you had to rewind all the tapes and blah, blah, blah. But the real thing this thing was so great at was, you know, that little peanut-shaped remote and the fact that that thing was so responsive. Back in the analog cable days, I don't even know what resolution it was. Was it like 480i, 480p, with like MPEG 1 code, or whatever garbage, like low resolution, primitive algorithms we had? That was the signal it was recording anyway. So responsive. Pause immediately, pause. Played immediately, played. You could fast forward and rewind in increments of X number of seconds as fast as you could hit that button. Just incredibly responsive, incredibly easy to navigate. Apple TV cannot touch the TiVo up, down, left, right, select button. Like, every menu was like the old iPhone. You go right to go into something, you go left to go out, up and down to scroll up and down. The whole interface was that. So fast, so simple, so readable from the couch. Everything was instant. Play the show, it's playing. Pause the show, it's pause. Skip commercial, it's like... And as time went on, and as HD came out and so on and so forth, the TiVos got worse. They became less responsive. The interface went through a terrible transition where it got way, way worse. And some of the interface was in non-HD, and some of them was in HD or whatever. And they declined. They diminished. They got worse at what they were doing. Streaming came and wiped them off the face of the earth. But today, with TiVo stopping the production, you can't even buy these anymore, although you shouldn't buy them because they're worse than the old ones. But stopping production of their hard drive-based DVRs, it's worth remembering just how good the TiVo was in its heyday and how it totally transformed my relationship with television. It stopped being a thing that I had to sit down at a certain time and watch or whatever. I stopped seeing commercials entirely, which kind of disconnected me from popular culture for a while because people would talk about commercials that were on TV and I'd never seen them. That's still kind of true to this day because I think a lot of people ad-supported streaming services and I don't. But what a piece of hardware. That remote, still amazing. By the way, if you have old TiVo remotes, you can teach the Apple TV to use them as long as you have IR line of sight to the thing. I don't necessarily recommend that because in some situations, the swipey pad is faster than the five-way button. But in every other respect, using a TiVo remote with your Apple TV is a much more pleasant experience. If only the Apple TV with 8 bajillion times the computing power was as responsive as like a Series 2 TiVo was back in the day. I'm sorry for young people who didn't experience this, but believe me, like, same way you don't believe that changing channels used to be as fast as it was back when we were little kids, because you've only ever seen a modern TV where changing channels takes for friggin' ever, whereas the channels used to change as fast as you could turn that dial. Like, yeah, analog. It had its downsides, but it also had its upsides. Anyway, with TiVo going away, I just want to remember TiVo for the great... I will always have great memories of it. It made my life better. It continues to make my life better, even as the company not goes out of business, but stops making those products. It still has a place in my entertainment center until the thing finally dies. And then I guess maybe someday I'll eventually be a quote-unquote cord cutter, because one thing I'm not doing is ever having a cable company box in my house. And that's the thing that I never did, because TiVo, this is another thing TiVo did. TiVo saved me from ever having a cable box. Every time I went over to someone's house and they had cable and I had to use the cable company cable box, man, it was grim. TiVo was just living in the future for at least a decade. And it also happened to coincide the time when both my kids were born, or at least my first kid and a little shading into the second. I do not know what I would have done without TiVo giving me all that stuff to watch at 3 a.m. as I bounce my children on a bouncy ball trying to get them to sleep.
You know, I, again, in the same way that I give Marco a lot of stick about fish, even though I bet you I would enjoy it a lot more than I admit, I give John a lot of stick about TiVo, particularly running it in the year of our Lord 2025. But with that said, what John described, I cannot begin to tell you how revolutionary it was. I mean, my children don't understand what commercials are, and that's not because of TiVo. That's because of the things that TiVo brought to us. And, you know, there was no cable company DVR that I was aware of until TiVo existed. I mean, it really was revolutionary. And if you're born in the year, you know, in the new millennium, if your birth date is it begins with a 2, I don't think you understand how incredibly revolutionary a DVR was, because, you know, my kids don't understand that there are things that you can only watch when they're airing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, as an example, there's a brief window of time over the summer where the family really got into Jeopardy, and then school happened. We've mostly fizzled about that. But they didn't understand that you couldn't just watch Jeopardy whenever the hell you want. Like, what do you mean it's not on?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
What does that even mean?
What is a channel? I don't even, like, I hear you say those words, but I don't know. What is a channel? What
you
does
mean
that
like a YouTube
mean?
Channel?
Right, exactly. And so all of that, to me, Genesis was the TiVo. And even though I think it's ridiculous to continue to use a TiVo,
it's not ridiculous. Like, if it keeps working, like, the ridiculous thing is paying for cable. That's the ridiculous thing. But having a TiVo in the house, if you are paying for cable, it's just great. It just makes cable better.
But so does channels. Like, they're much more modern.
I did try channels, and I do believe my current TiVo is still nicer than channels, because I tried it. I tried channels. I did it. Channels is really good. If TiVo didn't exist, maybe I would do it. But my TiVo is better than channels.
I'm not sure I agree, but you might be
if
right.
If the content was 4K, channels would be better, but it's not.
I mean, the channels will slurp up whatever you give it.
I know. But I'm saying, like, I don't. Fios doesn't deliver 4K Remember we went through this, like the Red Sox games every once in a while, and a few really high number channels, but almost everything else is not 4K.
Yeah.
Well, on the exact same day that TiVo stopped making DVRs, we also lost another revolution. AOL dial-up service ended.
Literally, the same day,
September 30th, both of these things died. It is kind of remarkable to think that those both had the same lifespan.
Although I would say that AOL dial-up service was revolutionary for a lot of people, but its useful lifespan was way shorter.
Yes, agreed. But also probably 10 years earlier. But yeah, the remarkable thing in both cases, in the case of AOL dial-up and of TiVo DVRs, in both cases, most people hearing the news today, the reaction is you could still get those.
Didn't they say that was still not dead. How many people were actually using dial-up when they stopped it? It was some number that's way bigger than you would think.
Maybe it was a couple hundred thousand, I think, or something like that.
Wonder if those are like accounts where that's just like some auto pay thing going on. And there's like, I have a hard time believing that there's 100,000 actual humans dialing up to AOL, but maybe, you know, like really old people, I don't know. It's just,
yeah, I mean, figure like maybe if you live somewhere rural where like you haven't had good internet service options for most of the time, you might still not, and you have really simple needs and you've been doing the same thing for 40 years, like maybe, yeah, okay.
I would think the capacitors would blow on their PCs.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, who even has modems?
Like, how is the modem still working?
Yeah, well, I guess like, you know, people still make like all-in-one printer, scanner, fax things. So the components must still be made for the fax modems in those. So I guess like you can still make a modem, but how would you get the computer version? Like, who even still makes? Like, I'm sure somebody makes like a USB.
Yeah,
one,
I mean, it, you know, it can happen. Like, hey, I've got my Synology down in the basement. Is that 13 years old of continuous running? And I've used my Mac Pro for 10 years. So like, I don't know, 30, 40, you could get lucky.
Yeah, but I bet Casey's right. I bet it's like mostly probably like subscriptions that were just never canceled at this point.
That was John that said that. But either way,
sorry.
I was looking for a link to put in the show notes and I stumbled on a Tom's Hardware link. In the U.S., there are still some ISPs which can make good use of your old U.S. Robotics Sportster 56K or Diamond Super Express modems. The biggest name alternative
Diamond.
Would be MSN.
No, the Sportster was the best one. Come on, we all know that.
We all know that. We've been through this many times. The biggest name alternative is MSN Dial-Up, which is $22 a month. There are also dial-up services offered by NetZero and Juno. Remember that
Juno
name?
Still exists?
That's a name I haven't heard of.
I wonder how many companies that's been passed around through.
Right?
That was my first, you know, quote, internet. I mean, that was when it was back when it was just email. Like, that was my first
internet access. Netcom.com. What a domain name.
That's incredible. Finishing up from Tom's Hardware, we recently also had the pleasure of seeing a pair of network enthusiasts bond 12 56K modems together to set dial-up broadband records. They managed to achieve a record 668 kilobits per second using multi-link PPP
technology.
It's like
the floppy disk raids.
Right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Remember those?
Oh, gosh.
The term broadband is being used pretty generously here.
I mean, they maybe need broad, like, physical width.
Yeah, right. All those modems
lined up. Those modems, it's pretty broad.
Right? All right, let's see some titles.
I still got the chicken salad page open. I wonder if that delivered to me.
You could come visit, John. That is something you could do.
Yeah, I'm going to go to chicken salad. I can stop in New York and get chicken salad.
Jesus fucking Christ, John. There exist decent foods other than two fucking places
on
the planet. Jesus fuck, John. Oh my God, you're killing me. You are.
I like that you have the little chicken salad place, but delis have all sorts of stuff.
Delis exist other than New York, John.
They don't actually. They actually don't.
Yeah, not the New York style deli. They don't.
Oh,
sorry, Casey.
No, they actually do, Marco. They say on the sign, New York style deli.
Well, yeah,
that's a warning sign.
Try to find the roles.
Titles. I'm going to have a goddamn aneurysm. All right. Let's see. An unadorned Casey, I suggested.
This was Marco misusing the word adorned.
No, I thought that was a deliberate misuse.
No. He just picked a humorously incorrect word. But
all right, fine.
I don't like the title, though. Let me see.
Misconnections for Nerds.
I do like
that
one.
I dare you to Google this.
I do like that one. Yeah, those two.
Is that what it's called? Misconnections? Did I get that wrong?
Yeah, I think so.
I think so.
I think that's right.
Like, I saw you on the subway. You were reading a book.
It's not the cable's fault. It's good.
I did realize, like, as I'm looking for people using my app, I did realize, like, I kind of have a big factor working against me, which is most people using my app are not looking at it. Like,
yeah,
it's just in their pocket.
You don't need to stare at the screen, although they should if they knew about chapters and chapter art, but that's just our show.
Yeah. And the chapters.
And also not all the time.
Yeah.
So you just look at the image, put it back in your pocket. Yeah, that is probably really hurting you seeing the thing.
It's all chicken salad. Did we? Oh yeah, we did say that about the restaurant. That's pretty good, because that's so freaking random.
I do like
this.
That
is number two. It's a poop joke.
You're gonna allow a poop joke?
No, it's not that good.
We have better.
Exactly. I think that might
be
my favorite.
So definitively, like my number one. Marco's like my number one concert was this fish show, but this is number two.
Yeah. Look, I'm honest. I mean,
this is poop. Yeah.
Fish at the Sphere was real. Like, oh my God. Like that's pretty hard to top.
I think my favorite is It's All Chicken Salad, again, because
of the randomness.
I like
slide it over with an exclamation point.
No, I don't like
Where's the chicken salad one? Where is that?
Twos.
In the twos.
And we didn't get a lot of votes today, but yeah, I do like It's All Chicken Salad and Misconnections for Nerds. Those are my
top
two.
I'm fine with chicken salad. I love chicken salad.
All right. That's going to be so freaking random.
We're a pro-chicken salad
podcast.
Perfect.
All right, going in the robot. Give me a second, then we can do some overtime.
That's great.
All right.
That's on one of my sort of banned foods list. I also love canned tuna with too much mayonnaise.
What do you mean banned foods? What do you mean by that?
My low cholesterol diet where I gave up ice cream.
Oh, whoa.
Oh, you're still on that?
Yeah, like for the rest of my life, yeah.
Oh.
As you get older, you don't come out of the instincts like, oh, you're still on that?
Yeah.
So your heart's still bad or is it better now? No, it's better. It's fixed. I have the heart of a 20-year-old.
Something like that. All right. Goodbye, live people. I believe we're, for the near future, we are regular time. So goodbye, live people. Thank you for being live people.
Bye, live people.